This meeting of the Board of Regents will come back to order. We will start with item number 20, public comment. Chief of Staff Gould.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A public comment will be taken during this agenda item. No action may be taken on a matter raised under this item until the matter is included on an agenda as an item on which action may be taken. Comments will be limited to 2 minutes per person. Persons making comment will be asked to begin by stating their name for the record and to spell their last name. The Board Chair may elect to allow additional public comment on a specific agenda item when that agenda item is being considered. In accordance with Attorney General Opinion Number 00-047, as restated in the Attorney General's Open Meeting Law Manual, the Board Chair may prohibit comment if the content of that comment is a topic that is not relevant to or within the authority of the Board of Regents, or if the content is willfully disruptive of the meeting by being irrelevant, repetitious, slanderous, offensive, inflammatory, irrational, or amounting to personal attacks or interfering with the rights of other speakers. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Do we have any public comment in ELCO?
No public comment from ELCO.
Do we have any public comment in Reno?
Yes, we have several here in Reno.
If you could state your name and spell your last name, and you have 2 minutes.
Hello, my name is Stacy Spain. And the last name is S-P-A-I-N. I am an instructor in theater at TMCC, and I am here today in support of the NISHI Foster Youth Initiative Program. Knowing that the most personal is the most universal, I wanted to share that I am part of the 3% of foster care kids who aged out of the system, and boy, have I aged out. But students who go to college and graduate from college. I have a BA in theater from ESU. Sorry, I know it's a rival. And my MFA is from Purdue University. Foster kids can't make any mistakes in order to be able to get to college and to succeed. There is no net. And this program, which I'm speaking in support of, provides a net, provides, money for books or perhaps money for a month worth of rent. When students are worried about what they're going to eat, it's really hard to focus on being successful in school. And I believe that this is going to have such a huge direct impact on students being able to be successful and being able to graduate and move on and become really successful in their lives. And I just wanted to speak in support of it and say thank you guys so much for making this initiative happen, and I'm happy that the additional funding has become available.
Thank you. Next.
For the record, Yvonne Allen, A-L-L-E-N. Good morning, Regents. I'm the Program Director for Equity, Inclusion, and Sustainability at Truckee Meadows Community College. Today I'm providing comment on Agenda Item 26, the NCU Foster Youth Success Initiative. I would like to give special thanks to the Walter S. Johnson Foundation, including Yali Lindcroft, for their support for the TMCC Foster Youth Initiative. At TMCC, we strive for student success to pair up the NCHI Foster Youth Waiver with our on-campus supports and programs. With the backing of the Walter S. Johnson Foundation, we now get to expand our reach and we get to expand the services that we're able to provide for this special population. I also would like to thank the Chancellor Riley, and staff for the statewide communication and collaboration that you're able to facilitate. Those roundtables were amazing. I look forward to the presentation later today. And I would like to encourage and support the recommendations to expand the waiver to our foster youth that identify as undocumented. Thank you.
Thank you. Next.
Yes, hello. My name is Damon Little. For the record, that's L-I-T-T-L-E. Good morning, Regents. I'd just like to add, I'm a student, and I would like to comment on regarding the upcoming presidential search regarding our campus. And I'd just like to say that I and many other students on our campus are looking for an individual that will prioritize and expand diversity and inclusion initiatives. And that's all I'd like to say. Thank you, and good morning.
Thank you. Next.
Good morning, Regents. My name is Joko Kalis. That last name is C-A-I, LLES, a senior up here at UNR, and I wanted to speak in favor of a resolution that was passed by ASUN Senate, a resolution in support of a policy to condemn racial hair discrimination. So I've had conversations with ASUN's Director of Diversity and Inclusion, Ayanna Relaford, and she mentioned that there have been instances of students facing hostile rhetoric from professors, specifically students of color, based on their hairstyle. And the ASUN Senate wanted to take action by encouraging the NC Board of Regents to adopt a policy which prohibits faculty or other staff members associated with the University of Nevada system or with any of the public colleges, preventing discrimination based on hairstyle discrimination. Other states such as California and New York have adopted similar policies, and we think that this is a common sense solution, which will make sure that students of color can feel safe on their campus. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Next.
Good morning, Regents. My name is Chase McAmer, MCNNAMARA. I'm a student of the University of Nevada, Reno. I come here to represent and talk about the ASUN legislative priorities of safety and transportation related to the UNR campus. My experience as a cyclist around UNR, I've experienced numerous encounters with different cars, different pedestrians. It is a matter of time before a student is seriously hurt in this regard. With the continued expansion of traffic congestion around the area and student enrollment at the university, I feel that it is crucial that we work on creating a solution where we provide a better and safe environment so that no harm causes to any student traffic-wise. Thank you.
Thank you. Next.
Good morning. My name is Kent Irvin, ERVIN, professor at UNR. I would like to comment on the upcoming budget process. Yesterday, Andrew Klinger showed an interesting chart, page 30 of his presentation, that shows that WSCH weighted student resident student credit hours funding from the state has been flat since 2014 after inflation. Putting this in some context, first, 2014 was the depth of the post-recession cuts, so the formula bakes in those cuts. Despite the entire process of adjusted base budgets, maintenance increases, and supposed enhancement, in three legislative sessions since 2014, the formula part of the budget has only kept up with enrollment growth and inflation. You might have had, as well have had, a true formula funding with inflation-adjusted credit hour values paid out based on the numbers at each campus. That would actually have been more fair. The governor and legislature have been unwilling to fund merit. The past legislature cut funding for research at the universities. Asking for more of the same is unlikely to be effective until legislative money committee leadership changes. What do they care about more? Providing high-quality education to students. So the better question is whether the current $164 per credit hour fees is sufficient to fund a student-to-advisor ratio of 350, or a student-to-faculty ratio of 18 at the R1 universities an appropriate target at these colleges. I suspect not, but a rigorous analysis would be helpful. A strategy to consider rather than requesting specific enhancements for salaries or research is to focus on student needs overall in terms of the staff-to-student ratios. Then NCHU could take care of salaries and research initiatives on our own. What should not continue to happen is that the serious salary and depression issue is not addressed in favor of new hires that we can't retain long-term without a comprehensive salary advancement system. Finally, while state funding per FTE is just an average for the nation, our student fees are relatively low, and that gives some room for modest adjustment if it's helping increase those student-to-faculty ratios. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Next.
Think that's offered today.
Thank you. Do we have any public comment here in Las Vegas? If so, please approach the podium, state your name, spell your last name, and you have 2 minutes.
Yes, hello. My name is John Aliano, and I'm the Program Director of Videography and Film at CSN, and that's Aliano. I am also a member of the collective bargaining team with NFA, and we have been bargaining now for over 3 years to get the agreement going. You've listened to several members from the other day, I believe about 10 of them, speaking in favor of this, and I really am seeking the support of the regents to help us in our efforts to do this. I know I only have 2 minutes, so I'll give a quick example. The reason we are doing things like this is we want to support the NSHE system. And one example is Section 4.2.3 in regards to market hires. I am one of them. Many of them have been hired as people who, in violation of that code, were not given a choice between market hire and tenure track. It's stated in NSHE code that you should be. It's happened for 15 years that they have not done that. I represent those people. There's one woman who has now lost over $150,000 in salary because of that over this 15-year period, and this should not exist. By having collective bargaining, that will supersede NSHE code and guarantee that these people will be able to have the choices they should have been guaranteed in there. This is just one instance of what's been going on for a long, long time. And I know that you can help us, support us, because over 3 years in collective bargaining is far too long. It's far too long. It's time to settle a contract, make this work so we can help you and you can help us, and we can do what we were brought here to do, the business of teaching and student success. Thank you.
Thank you. Next.
Good morning. My name is Denise Tanada. I serve as the executive director at the Children's Advocacy Alliance, which is a statewide nonprofit organization dedicated to serving as an independent voice for children and families to improve policies and practices in the areas of children's health, school readiness, child welfare, and economic security. It was my pleasure to stand before this body last September in support of the tuition fee waiver program for Nevada's foster youth, and I again thank you for your support and encouragement. It's also been my honor this year to work collaboratively with the Chancellor's Office, the Child Welfare Agencies, and numerous other community partners on implementation and outreach. But more importantly, as identified during the Board of Regents meeting last year, we know that the fee waivers alone are not enough for these students. Campus-based wraparound support services are critical to the success of these young people and should be developed based on the specific, unique needs of this population and delivered by knowledgeable professionals that are trained in working with transition-age foster youth. We know that the Chancellor's Office has taken significant measures to support the development of these programs, including the establishment of the Foster Youth Ambassador position, supported by the Walter S. Johnson Foundation, engaging youth to identify their specific needs, and supporting professional development, collaboration, and alignment of services across the system's institutions. I strongly encourage your continued support of the NSHE Foster Youth Success Initiative and any and all measures that you're able to make to sustain and grow these efforts to serve and support these much-deserving students. Thank you.
Thank you. Next.
Good morning. My name is Dewey Fowler. I'm actually a CAP attorney with the Legal Aid Center of Southern Nevada. For the record, last name F-O-W-L-E-R. So first, I want to commend the board on the phenomenal work you have done with the implementation of the Foster Youth Fee Waiver, and most importantly, for affording the youth with the opportunity to pursue post-secondary education. And frankly, it's something that would be extremely difficult for our clients without the fee waiver. So again, I thank you. As an attorney for several of the youth, I see firsthand how your work has enriched their lives by giving them the necessary knowledge, skills, and training to succeed in the future. But I would be remiss if I didn't impress upon the board that the fee waiver is one of many steps that must be taken to best serve our youth as they pursue their higher education. And so going forward, I remain very hopeful that during this session you will address several barriers to higher education that our youth have identified. And I think most pertinently, they include streamlining the financial aid and admissions process, connecting the youth with financial resources to assist with school-related expenses, and also housing expenses. So on behalf of Legal Aid Center and Barbara Buckley, Executive Director, we want to express our public support for the Foster Youth Success Initiative, and I want to thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you. Next.
Hello and good morning. My name is Judy Tudor, T-U-D-O-R, and I am an assistant director for the Department of Family Services. I come before you today after being here last year in September when you all took on the step of approving the foster youth fee waiver. And so in my role last year, I was here as a former foster youth, a UNLV graduate, as well as a UNLV employee. And now I have the pleasure of serving at the Department of Family Services as one of their assistant directors. And we have had the pleasure of partnering with NSHE and the Foster Youth Ambassador, Laura Orbis, over this past year to really start to look at what services we can provide on campus to support our young people. When you passed this initiative last year, we had some discussion about how this was the first step to help our foster youth be able to get higher education. But we also talked about the idea that we also have to support them and get them to graduation. And so our focus has been on supporting and developing services to support those foster youth. We've been partnering with other community partners like Project We to talk about how we develop mentoring, how we develop branding around the foster youth fee waiver, and how we provide additional workforce development so that our foster youth are supported. We're stepping up to help provide education to NSHE campuses about this population, and you'll hear a little later from our director, Administrator Tim Birch, about some new efforts to really support housing efforts for foster youth while they're achieving secondary education. So I want you to know that we are here partnering with all of you to help our youth be successful, not only when they get on campus, but how we can help them to get through to graduation. I, again, as a former foster youth, a former employee, and now in my role at Department of Family Services, it's an honor to be a part of this initiative and to see how it's affecting our young people to be successful. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Next.
Good morning. My name is Natasha White, and I White, W-H-I-T-E for the record. I am a senior at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas, and I am the National Communications Coordinator and Vice President for the Residence Hall Association. I am here today to voice the resident student support for the food service rate increase that is being brought forth to you all. We understand the financial need for it and are overall in support of it. Thank you.
Thank you. Next.
Good morning. My name is Gard Jamison. I am the co-founder of the Children's Advocacy Alliance, the statewide advocacy group for children. And I'm mostly here to say thank you. You've done a huge service to our foster youth by this initiative. And I think in the narrative of NSHE, this will go down as one of your greatest accomplishments. And I want everybody to appreciate that this is really a bipartisan opportunity. We had Vanderbilt do a study of the cost of a kid who falls through the cracks, and they estimated it's about $3 million. But that's just the economic cost. The human cost is so much more than that. So what you've done and what you will be doing by providing wraparound services, I think, again, provides a huge platform of opportunity for these children. In the state of New York, and I've been trying to get the Department of Corrections to do a census here in the state of Nevada, but over 50% of the incarcerated individuals are former foster youth. To quote the great philosopher, and I have the privilege of teaching philosophy here at the university, thank you, Marta, the great philosopher Chris Rock, that's not right. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Next.
For the record, I'm Matthew Sunilvare, V-A-R-R-E. I'm a third-year doctoral student at UNLV, representing the GPSA. I'm here to advocate for the special fee increase to support GPSA activities. We have a travel and research scholarship support through competitive process by the GPSA, and I have been the recipient of the research and the travel scholarships to attend conferences, also purchase equipment and software to conduct my research, and especially this is helpful to build networks, talk to people in your field as a researcher, discuss ideas, and maybe maybe score a job, I guess, in future once I graduate. And that's really helpful in terms of attending conferences. And also GPS supports the graduate commons in the lead library, which is a dedicated space for graduate students for some quiet workspace where we have specialized software, MATLAB and SPSS, and then also a conference room where we have a lot of workshops, which helps develop our professional activities. And I'm, and then I would, and these are only the couple of things that were provided by GPSA, and these awards and space are only possible because of GPSA efforts and the fee. And this fee would further increase the GPSA support to all the graduate and professional student community at UNLV and also our professional growth. Thank you.
Thank you. Next.
Good morning. I'm Chen Chen Li for the record, and my last name, L.I. I'm the third year doctor student. I'm speaking for UNLV GPSA. I'd like to share how I have been benefiting from UNLV GPSA, the special fee. I received three times the GPSA sponsorship for my international conferences to support me to attend all the conferences to share my research to the scholars from all over the world to get the constructive feedback to help me further conduct my research and publish articles to the peer-reviewed journals. What's more, I can interact and network with the scholars in the academia. As an international graduate student, I solely live on my GE package for survival, so it's hard for me to manage money to attend all the international conferences. I had 16 proposals accepted when I came here, the UNLV. However, I cannot attend all the conferences because the tight budget of GPSA, it cannot support me to attend all the conferences. But thanks to GPSA, I can attend half of the conference and share my proposals. So here, I believe that UNLV GPSA special fee revision definitely could empower our graduate rebels to accelerate our academic progress. Thank you.
Thank you. Next.
For the record, Stephanie Molina, M-O-L-I-N-A. I'm a fifth-year doctoral student speaking in favor of the UNLV GPSA special fee revision under agenda item number 28. As a graduate student, I see the fee as an investment in my educational and professional development growth. And while I don't usually take advantage of the services offered by the GPSA every semester, I kind of see paying into the fee kind of as an investment in my educational future. For example, it's provided me travel funds to present at an internationally recognized conference, and so without those funds, I would not have been able to represent my department and UNLV as well as ANSHI in that capacity. Additionally, as the UNLV GPSA president, the fee revision has been a near 2-year project over my 2-year term. In this position as president, and over this time we have been able to expand this competitive student research and travel awards, the budget, by over 15% just by simply ensuring that our fee revenue is actually being returned to the students a little bit better. And we have also increased the budget for book scholarships, which we offered through the GPSA, and we are able to institute some new projects that we've kind of started hoping that the fee actually gets passed. And hopefully we'll be able to keep up with those projects in the future. As you can see, graduate students like myself greatly benefit from the GPSA fee comprehensively through the services that we offer, not just academic-based, but also for our professional development. Thank you.
Thank you. Bless you. Delayed bless you.
Hello, everyone. My name is Alexandra Patri, P-A-T-R-I, and I am the Student Government Association President at Truckee Meadows Community College. Getting a college degree is vital for students so that they can have a career that will make a good enough income to sustain themselves in the long run, but they have to go into debt first. One of the most expensive purchases college students have to splurge on in order to get their degree are college textbooks. The textbook's cost has risen 4 times faster than the rate of inflation over the past 10 years. That has caused 65% of students to skip buying the required textbooks and at some point in their college career because of the lack of affordability. Because of this, graduation rates go down since without the required textbooks, students usually fail the class. However, there is a way to help students save money on textbooks, and that solution is Open Educational Resources. Open Educational Resources are e-textbooks and learning content that is available at little or no cost online that can be used for teaching, learning, or research. The average college student spends more than $1,200 on books and materials per year, but Open Educational Resources give students the ability to learn using similar resources for a cost next to nothing. We have the ability to share these resources with our colleges. All we need is faculty to implement this in their classrooms. Instead of assigning $300 textbooks, assign the free version that is a similar resource to your students. If you have the ability, why not try? I asked this question to professors at Truckee Meadows Community College, and they stated that it would be too much work for them to change their curriculum. Frankly, they did not want to learn how to add open educational resources to their course because they did not want to admit that they did not know how. Why is it that teachers are willing to teach students but are not willing to learn how to help them? Maybe it is simpler for teachers to use My Math Lab and assign homework and quizzes that they did not have to make themselves. Maybe it is simpler to not have to change the curriculum that you have been teaching for the last 20 years. But technology is catching up to us, and it won't wait. In the year 2000, 5% of the world population was using the Internet. Just 19 years later, 59% of the world is using the Internet. The Internet is our future, and so is Open Educational Resources. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any other public comment in Las Vegas? Seeing none, we will close public comment and move to item number 19, Institutional and System Administration Plans to Cover Budget Shortfall from the Cost of Living Adjustment, CFO Klinger.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, Regents. This will be much shorter than yesterday's presentation. Just here to present for the board the institution's plans to cover the COLA shortfall. And just a reminder for the committee, when we closed the budget, the legislature approved 64% funding for the 3% cost of living, whereas typically they fund that at 80%. Our original estimate for that shortfall was 3.2. After finalizing the numbers, that shortfall came out to about $2.8 million for the entire system. So the institutions were asked to provide plans on how each of them was were going to cover that shortfall. What the institutions did almost across the board was a combination of a few things. It was a delay in hiring positions. It was holding positions vacant. And those are really are the main savings. In UNLV's response, they also put in there the other impacts that they felt, the changes in the formula and some other things that had an impact. And really what I would say is all of the institutions felt those impacts from those other reductions as well. Happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Regent Trachuk.
I have a question. I know this isn't an action item, but we haven't implemented these cuts yet. My understanding is we're waiting until the next fiscal year to implement these proposed cuts. Is that correct?
That is incorrect. These are what we implemented for this current year. We don't have a plan for the next year.
So the ship's already sailed. We're stuck with these.
For this current year, definitely.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The institutions have been holding positions vacant in some cases since July 1st to cover this shortfall and delayed hiring positions for the fiscal year that started July 1st. So, yes, they've already started these reductions.
And as we discussed previously, this is what we have to do to balance the budget this year and cover the COLA. We are still talking with legislators, the Chancellor and I, and seeing if there's a way to get these funds back going forward and in the second year of the biennium.
So it's too late for us to revisit our decision last June to grant this, a half of a percent of the COLA and make the cuts and these reductions that are being presented to us today.
I believe so. Regent Hayes, then Perkins, then Page.
Yeah, I just, as I look through this, I would like to ask the institutions to maybe take a hard look at their staffing. If they can afford to leave this many positions vacant for this long of a time, how crucial and vital are these positions actually? I mean, I know some of it will just be somebody's going to have to do a lot of extra work and probably work some nights and weekends, which please thank them for us. But are all of these positions that vital if we have that many positions that we can leave open to save that much money? And I'm sorry, UNLV, but advising positions is where you went to cut out of everything? I mean, advising, and I've said this since I got on the board, when they changed the formula in 2013, there is a return on investment for advising. Now that we pay for completions, or the state pays for completions, every student who stays in school makes more money for your institution. Like, advising is not a cost anymore. That is a money-making position. And we always seem to look to, and it's not just UNLV, it is in this case, but it seems like advising is the one area that people are like, oh, well, maybe we won't put as much money into advising. That's where you make money. That keeps people in school. It keeps them completing courses. And I don't know what I'm missing with this. It's been 5 years now, and I've never understood why I see this in a different way. Like, advising makes money for you. Put money into it. And that's all I got. Thanks.
President Miana?
Just to clarify, Regent Hayes, we did not cut advising positions. We had planned on 20 new academic advisors to get us closer to that 350-to-1 ratio. But, you know, when you're stuck having to save $1,147,000, you've got to find it in different places. And so what we did is we cut the number of planned positions. We're planning on 20 new positions for first-year support to 10. And I agree with you, it's a terrible shame, and it's a big cost. But we couldn't do it just with the vacant positions for all the reasons you just said. So it is sad.
Thank you. Regent Page?
Thank you, Chair Geddes. You know, when we did this vote, I think a lot of people didn't think it was a big deal. Let's just vote, and, you know, COLA was important. And again, I agree, COLA was important. But I think it was a mistake not to to push back on this, because I really think going forward, and time will tell whether our funding's cut permanently for COLA. And I'd be very curious to see how your conversations are going with legislators, because there was no appetite last session and when this was done. But I still think it's really, really important. And then when you look at these numbers, yeah, $1,147,000 at UNLV for advisors. It's tough, right? We need more advisors. We need more positions, and we've got people. And as much as, you know, Regent Hayes says people could work nights and weekends, people are working pretty hard already. And so I think it's hard, difficult to tell people, hey, we want you to work harder. I think we need to continue to fight to get a proper COLA like everyone else got. Thank you.
Thank you. President Johnson?
Yes, I would say, and this is Mark Johnson from the University of Nevada, Reno. This was a surprise cut. These are not unneeded positions. It was just an unfunded mandate when we were forced to go ahead and give the 3% COLA, and then we had to find the money. So we lost $850,000 also in a completely unplanned cut. We should have had that money had it been appropriated, and we would have kept the positions in search that we need.
Brian, and then Regent Trajan.
I would just like to say the faculty are very appreciative that we got our COLA to have shortened the faculty from getting a 3% COLA that the rest of the state got would have been the wrong thing to do. So I'm very appreciative that the board chose to do what they did this past summer. Thank you.
Regent Trajan.
This board needs to understand this is on us. The money wasn't allocated, and we decided as a board to go forward and grant the raises. And now we're seeing what the impacts are. And the time was in June to have pushed back and said, we don't have the money, and we don't spend money that we don't have. And I think that was a mistake then, and I would like to see the board revisit this issue, because this is setting a very dangerous precedent, and we will be self-funding in the future, and we just gave the detractors of the system the roadmap going forward.
Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair Geddes. I'm basically saying the same thing as Regent Trachok, and we were put in a really difficult position. It's probably one of the toughest votes I've ever been in the 3 years I've been on the board, and it wasn't a pretty situation, and I really think it needs to be revisited, because if we're going to grow and maintain R1 and achieve all those five strategic goals that we have, and we're really doing well, we need our funding, and I didn't think it was right what the legislature did to us, and we don't really have a lot of recourse, but I think Regent Trachok's right. We need to push back and revisit it and come up with a better plan. It was a tough vote.
Regent McAdoo.
So I'm in agreement with everything that's been said, in addition to what you said, Brian. However, I live my personal life and I try to live my regent life that we cannot spend money we don't have. And in the ARSA meeting yesterday, we discussed that we have to stop these mandates without funding to make them happen. I still stand by that.
Seeing no other comments, thank you. We will go to item number 22, Procedures and Guideline Manual, Revision, Periodic Evaluation of Presidents. Chancellor Riley.
Thank you, Chair Geddes. Over the last several months, we have worked with staff, the Council of Presidents, and Faculty Senate to look at the periodic evaluation of presidents. And before you today are some, which I believe are some very positive changes that have been endorsed by all the parties concerning how we do evaluations. If I can just take you through a couple of them. The first one that I'd like to mention deals with the issue around the survey. So the previous way we have done the survey research is that each institution would have their faculty senate develop an instrument, and then that instrument would be used to as one of the tools to evaluate the president. What we're recommending today is that we have a standardized survey. We actually had a doctoral student from UNLV who specializes in survey research look at all our past evaluations and look at some national examples of evaluations and customize it towards NC Nevada. And so that instrument would be something that we would use ongoing. It would allow us for an apples-to-apples comparison among the institutions and among the presidents. Under this instrument, the instrument would be reviewed on an annual basis with both the presidents and the faculty senate. The faculty senate could recommend additional questions to the survey that could be added. Particularly with DRI, there would be a need for that to occur. But what we would do from moving forward is that we'd have the standardized survey. And the standardized survey would actually be administered by a third party. So they would collect the data. It's mostly descriptive statistics, then provide that information back to the evaluation committee. So that's the first major change. The second change is we really felt there was a need for consistency on how the four-person committee that is appointed evaluates the presidents. And to that end, we have agreed to have each of the institutions from their HR or otherwise designate an individual along with staff at ENCHI, and to train them consistently and then use that pool of individuals to serve as a facilitator and as a resource for the four-person committee. So that would be the second major change that we've made. The third one was to the issue has come up before, and although practice has always included classified staff, that was not in our policy. So we added that was one of the stakeholder groups that were required to outreach to. And then the other major change comes on the evaluations, the self-evaluations that the presidents are required to put together. And we added a section that dealt with a narrative around how they have addressed the NC strategic plan. And then a minor change, or not necessarily a minor change, but we clarified that on the area of governance, that the presidents would need to address how they deal with shared governance. And there were some minor other changes, but that's basically was the bulk of the changes that we were recommending. These new changes would go into effect for our evaluations that will begin at the beginning of 2020. And I'd be happy to answer any questions anyone has about the format that we're recommending.
Thank you. George?
Thank you. For the record, George Kleb, Faculty Senate Chair. It's spelled K-L-E-E-B. Just wanted to make a comment. Having went through this last year with President Helen's evaluation, the use of the outside third party will assist Faculty Senate. We still have the rights to be able to do the survey. We can propose questions. It simply is a win-win, because when we're trying to take this survey and create a document, probably right about the time spring break is going on, it just adds an administrative burden to us. So the use of the outside third party with consistent practices is simply a great way of improving this process.
Thank you. Regent Trajan?
Yeah, I would like to hear from the presidents and see what their thoughts are, since they're the ones and their successors are the ones that will be evaluated with this process.
Vince? President Solis?
Vince Solis, for the record. Thank you, Regent Trajan, for the question and the feedback. As being one of the presidents that will be evaluated in this coming cycle, I agree with the changes. I think it's important to have that outside perspective to be able to help guide that. But more importantly, you know, the confidentiality piece to the information that's collected is also important. As we all know, these things get out into cyberspace and they become permanent records. So I think that it's important to have one place that has a consistent approach to the collection of the information. I do agree that having the Faculty Senate provide questions as well to the survey is also useful. I saw the instrument. I was pleased with in terms of what I saw. I think it collects some of the things that are important to the things that we need to be evaluated on.
President Patterson.
Thanks. So obviously this has gone through an evolution. The board committee used to do the evaluation themselves. Then it was an outside evaluator that came in and did everything. I think this strikes kind of a nice balance. I'm sure we'll continue to tweak it as we go along, but I think this strikes a nice balance between having open kind of access, but also a better managed and maybe some HR professionalism added to it.
Any other presidents want to add? Or President Johnson?
Yes. I think we used to be evaluated by ad hoc committees, and therefore we got ad hoc results. I think the process the Chancellor has gone through by consulting with all the presidents who will be subject to this, and fortunately I'm not going to be subject to this again, and in consultation with the Faculty Senate was very important to have a standard survey that is adjustable with shared governance and having the additional questions posed. So I think it's a very fair process, and it gives us less of an ad hoc approach. Thanks.
Thank you. President Zaragoza?
Federico Zaragoza, for the record. I agree with most of the comments that have been made. I believe that it's really important to have a standardized process, yet the ability to localize it to our respective institutions. The third-party component will enhance, I believe, the way that we administer the consistency of the evaluation process. And I was very pleased in terms of just the engagement of the various institutional stakeholders to ensure that people understand exactly how this process is going to be rolling out. Confidentiality, again, in my mind, is one of those areas that I still worry a little bit about. Our reputations are on the line as it relates to how this process evolves, but it is what it is.
President Miana.
I basically echo most of what was said, with an emphasis on the third party and the standardization of the instrument. I have not gone through the process myself, but I have witnessed other presidents go through it, and I think these changes were much needed. Thank you.
President Hilgerson.
I think the changes are very good, but I also think there are still some structural issues with this process in comparison to other states. And I adore TMCC. I love being the president of TMCC. I work with excellent faculty and staff. But I just have to be very open and honest. This process is so time-consuming, extremely rigorous, which I think is very healthy for the first evaluation. But now that I'm about to embark on my second evaluation, I'll be truthful. I have anxiety about it. There are really much more important things I would love to be working on at TMCC rather than what is truly the most thorough and openly public presidential evaluation. And I believe it's probably the most thorough and publicly open presidential evaluation in the entire United States. And I think you need to hear that.
President Helens.
I want to thank Chancellor Riley for engaging us in a deep discussion regarding this. So this is just kind of a summary that we've been talking about, but we have had good deep discussion and commented on that in everything we do, we have to have consistent practice. And it has to be focused on effectiveness and data. And we really need that to be less of a six-month, time-consuming kind of process. So the idea of having some assistance from outside or professionals who do this for a living, I think will help our process immensely.
President Acharya.
I agree with most of what was said, and I don't have any additional comments. Thanks.
Regent Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm very happy to have the president's administration and faculty, you know, deeply involved in this process. It's really important for them to weigh in. And also, are there weighted questions in there? Like, is one topic more important than another, and will that be seen in the evaluation, or did I miss that part?
They're not weighted in the sense of one section of is more than the other. We did make it clear that the comments are a personnel document, that they are provided to the committee as one way to present the thematic issues so that they'll pull from it.
Regent Lieberman.
As far as consistency and sticking with the same process across the board, and I think we've come a long way, and if we need to make changes later on, we will. But I think this is the way to go for the next two cycles, and then we can reevaluate.
Thank you. Do I have a motion? Motion from Regent Trachok, second from Regent Del Carlo. Any other comments or questions? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. We will now go into recess of the board and reconvene as the foundation of the College of Southern Nevada. The Board of Regents will now come back to order. Just a housekeeping note for everybody out there is we are going to postpone the athletic department annual reports to the March meeting and the financial. We will get some procedures and guideline manuals and some standardized financial reporting, and we'll bring those back in March. Let your appropriate athletic directors know they can go home and start working on the report for March. We will now go to item number 24, Institutional Metrics Report, UNLV, President Miana.
Marta Miana for the record. Thank you all for the opportunity to present on UNLV's progress toward the achievement of all the reasons we all work here. The way this is going to work is that during the course of this presentation, I'm going to be showing UNLV's most recently available data for several of the NC strategic plan metrics in the five key areas laid out by the board. In addition, I will weave throughout the presentation some of the programmatic efforts that we have implemented to impact these key metrics and some of the ongoing challenges that we face in maintaining our upward momentum. So let's start with enrollment. As you can see, in fall 2019, we achieved a record high in overall enrollment. Those are the big numbers, the numbers that you see at the very, very top. And as you see, we are now above 31,000 students. Undergraduate enrollment is at a record high, as well as professional student enrollment with the introduction of our third cohort of medical students. So the gray that you see there is the graduate students, the red is the undergraduate. So compared with last year, the university increased enrollment at all student levels. Now, if we look at a five-year span, what you'll see is that our enrollment in each level has increased significantly with a total overall five-year increase of 9%. The really big increase you see there of 37% growth in professional students is, again, due to the creation of the medical school. Now, we also embrace strongly our access mission at UNLV. And as you will see, minority enrollment has dramatically increased over the past 5 years. Every ethnic minority group except Pacific Islanders has grown, and minority students now make up 63.3% of our total enrollment. Among undergraduate students, Hispanics are the largest group. When you look at the projections of the demographics of future high school graduates in the United States, you see that UNLV really is the face of the future of public higher education. Now, one of the major elements that goes into meeting our access mission is our financial aid strategy. Our total aid distributed over the last past four years has grown over 13%. And it's clear that this has not been driven simply by increasing loan amounts to our students, as our loan aid, if you look up there at the, in that little box, has only increased by 4.2% in the same time period. If you look at just the last 3 years, loans have increased by $1 million, whereas our total aid increased by over $25 million, as our grant in aid, student employment, and scholarship amounts have increased. In fact, we distribute grant or scholarship aid to 60% of our undergraduate students and 85% of our new first-year students. And this is significant, as our student population is a high-need population, with 36% of all undergraduate and 41% of new first-year students receiving Pell Grants. This is a photo from our annual fall UNLV Creates event, which welcomes incoming new students, 51% of whom come from homes in which neither parent earned a bachelor's degree. Every student deserves our support and guidance on their journey to graduation, and we're proud to serve this population. This is a really wonderful event where they come in before they start the semester, and we really have a celebration of their entry into college life and a pledge to do their very best to finish and to graduate. Now, always interesting to look at ACT. So in terms of ACT readiness benchmarks, UNLV is typically higher than the overall national average, in which 39% of students score as college ready in three or more areas. And for your information, those areas are science, math, English, and reading. However, less than half of the students in our incoming class are prepared on three of the four college subject areas as determined by ACT. So this is something that really cues us to the fact that these students are going to need support and extra help.
President Miana?
Yes.
We have a question from Regent Hayes.
Sorry, yes.
Yes, thank you, Chair Geddes. President Meehan, I was just curious, how did these ACT readiness benchmarks compare to our aspirational schools and the peer schools?
I don't have that data for you. I do have a comparison to our aspirational on in terms of graduation rates. I don't have the ACT readiness stats, but I will get those for you.
Because that actually is what got me thinking about is the graduation rates is how are how is the preparation of the students that are coming into UNLV maybe having an effect on the ultimate graduation rate compared to our peer and aspirational schools?
I will get that information for you. Okay, then if we look at the same type of stats, readiness benchmarks by ethnicity, you'll see that there are distinct differences across ethnic groups in ACT readiness benchmarks. And students from historically underrepresented groups are less likely to meet three or more benchmarks than their white peers. And these differences largely mirror national data. And as we will see, these college readiness gaps for our students as measured by ACT scores are actually much larger than our first-year retention gaps. So that suggests that underrepresented minority students are more likely to succeed in their first year at UNLV than their ACT scores might predict. So we would like to think that our first-year support is partly responsible for that. However, we recognize that removing barriers to access is not enough. Every student we admit to UNLV has to have the opportunities, tools, and resources they need to succeed, and should feel that they're supported and cared for. This is a quote from one of our students who benefited from the services of our student outreach specialist, which I'll discuss a little more as I talk about our student success outcomes. And I think this quote kind of speaks to our efforts to help all our students succeed at UNLV. They really express to us that they need to feel that someone's out there watching for them and caring about what happens. So if we move to our first-year retention rates, our first-year retention rate this year is 79.4%. This is a record high for the university, and it is an increase of 3.5% from last year. I believe that a few of our retention initiatives have helped contribute to this record high, including our first-year seminars. So these are seminars into which first-year students are put into that orient them either to their major or to an exploring capacity. And we know that participants in those first-year seminars are more than 20% more likely to be retained to their second year. Additionally, what we've done is we've greatly expanded our early alerts in 100 and 200 level classes. And these early alerts identify students who are struggling in their first few weeks so that we can catch them as early as possible and guide them to campus resources that would support their success. And finally, thanks to our revision of the Academic Success Center Pathways programs, they're now working with more than 630 students on a STEM or business pathway who don't place into college-level math. As you know, math continues to be a challenge. Those students receive intensive math support, coaching, and one of these first-year seminars in academic advising that's focused on their major or career exploration to ensure that they make it into their desired major or, if they can't, select the one best suited to their actual strengths and interests so we don't lose them. Retention rates for this group increased, the group that was in this Pathways program, 12.9% over the past 2 years. Now, first-year retention rates are up in nearly every ethnic group, which we're very happy about. So the achievement gap has been reduced, and in some ethnic groups has disappeared, actually. Now, this is, of course, only one cohort of data, but the results are extremely encouraging. Some of the programs that are helping us reduce the achievement gap include our Center for Academic Enrichment and Outreach programs that serve hundreds of low-income and minority students at UNLV and thousands of middle and high school students in the Valley. And these programs focus on college interest, readiness, and success. We know that our students of color are overrepresented in the cohort of first-year students who enter UNLV with three or more risk factors for attrition. And so what we've done is we've supplemented support for them with student outreach specialists. And these are specialists who call and email at-risk students at key times during the semester to check on their progress, to remind them of important deadlines, and to direct them to services that are going to resolve the challenges that they claim to be facing. Retention for this student population has increased by 7.6% since the program's inception 2 years ago, the specialist outreach program. For most ethnic groups served by the student outreach specialist, the retention gap has been greatly reduced and in some cases completely eliminated. So the changes in our achievement gap are American Indian, Alaska Native last year were 8.2% below white students and now are 3.4% below them. It's a small cohort, but still something to note. African American students were 6.1% below whites last year and now are only 2.2% below. Hispanic students were 1.7% below white students in retention and now are 2.3% above Caucasian students. So as you can see, we are starting to make progress toward closing that gap. Now, before I go to graduation rates.
President Miana?
Yes.
Regent Del Carlo?
Thank you, Chair. President Miana, this is wonderful. So those persons that are doing the calling, they're calling and they're emailing, are they advisors or are they mentors, volunteers, on staff? How are you doing that? Because this is really impressive.
Yeah. The student outreach specialists, I believe, are senior students. I'm going to get the provost to confirm this for me because I'm not entirely sure. They're grad students. That's what I thought. So they're not senior grad. They're grad students who do this. Thank you, Chris.
As a follow-up, I just, you know, if that's going to, it is working. You've got the data. I mean, maybe that becomes a best practice for and shared at the other institutions for closing that gap. That's great.
It's amazing what just paying attention to the kids who are who are having trouble does.
And
right?
It goes back to the quote of the student. There's someone watching over me and cares.
Right.
Thank you. Well done.
Thank you. As I move on to graduation rates, most of the time when you hear about all of our graduation rates, we're talking about six-year graduation rates. But I'm going to start with four-year, which are always scarier looking, but really important because we want our students to finish as soon as possible. So over the past 5 years, we have seen a fairly steady rise in our four-year graduation rates, and this year's rate of 19.2% is a record high for the university. The 15 to finish initiative, which had that as its goal to get students to get their degrees as quickly as possible, has had a significant positive impact on these four-year graduation rates. We continue to administratively enroll all new freshmen in 15 credits. Of course, we don't always control whether they drop a course later, but our analyses show that even students who were predicted to enroll in fewer credits were more successful when they were administratively enrolled in 15 credits. Okay, now, the four-year graduation rates by ethnicity. When examining the achievement gap, clearly, undeniably, we have a lot of work to do, particularly among American Indian and Black students. We know there's a gap between minority students and majority students on college readiness, and we know our minority students are overrepresented among students with three or more risk factors for attrition. However, early indicators in retention rates for those in recently added programming that we've just started in the last couple of years and that we'll continue to monitor, I think we're going to see that, we're going to see the impacts of that in our graduation rates soon. So this is the four-year story. let's go to the more traditional six-year graduation rates. Now, I'll explain that that gray bar in a second. We have seen a steady rise in six-year graduation rates. Our most recent rate of 44.8% is, again, a record high for UNLV. And improvements in our four-year graduation rates have all obviously begun to influence these six-year rates. Advising outreach campaigns to 50-year students and immediate intervention for those who do not graduate in their intended semester have helped more students reach this six-year benchmark. Now, if you look at the gray bar, that's an eight-year graduation rate. We don't want to start talking about eight-year graduation rates, but I do think it's important to know that we do end up capturing more students later on. It's part of the story. So if you extend the frame on outcomes to an eight-year graduation, you'll see that there's this historic lag. The 2009 six-year graduation rate was 40.5%, and you see from this data that it increases 7.5% when you add two more years. And so this is why an increase in four-year graduation rates is so encouraging. It indicates we're beginning to reduce this delay. But it is important to know that just because they haven't graduated in 6 years doesn't mean they're not going to. Six-year graduation rates by ethnicity. The six-year cohort began really before many of the interventions that we have instituted and that I've discussed were put in place. So we know that there is serious ground to make up. It's only been a couple of years that we have these interventions in place. We're starting to see it in the retention rate. It'll take a little longer to see it in the graduation rates. We have historically had a graduation delay in some groups. For example, American Indian students and Hispanic students have more students that are still in enrolled status and not graduated by the six-year mark. However, signs from early results with retention are, as I said, encouraging, and we will see this, hope to see this carry out over time and close some of those gaps in six-year grad rates, since we're starting to close the gap in retention rates, right? So as you're closing the gap in retention rates between these groups, you should be seeing it down the road in those graduation rates. Again, these are students who came in 6 years ago. So although we have been able to reduce or eliminate disparities in first-year retention, it's clear that we have to do more to engage students beyond that first year. And by using a cohort-based approach with peer mentoring, academic support, early engagement with career services, we hope to substantially improve, as I said, the graduation rates for all of our students and to eliminate the gaps that are experienced by some of our minority students. Now, here's our slide where we compare, not on the ACT scores, I will get that for you, but on retention and graduation rates with our comparative and aspirational peers. So you'll see UNLV all the way to the left, and then San Diego State, UNT, and University of Texas, San Antonio being our peer institutions, and then you'll see our aspirational peers. In terms of our comparative peers, we have surpassed two schools in terms of retention, so I think you're seeing some good comparisons there. In terms of graduation, again, we have a ways to go to catch up to UNT or San Diego State. And needless to say, in terms of our aspirational peers, we will need to see very significant increases in our retention and graduation rates over time. So those are our goals, and Okay, go back. we're heartened by our gains in graduation rates as they point to UNLV's ability to help more students reach their ultimate goal of earning a degree. And that is what we are starting to witness now. We have seen steadily increasing degree counts. We now award more than 4,200 bachelor's degrees each academic year, and we have seen five-year increases at all levels. Again, the red is the bachelor, the gray is the master's, and then you've got the other gray is the doctoral, and then the professional doctorate numbers at the top of the bars. If you look at it over 5 years, as you can see on this slide, bachelor's degrees have gone up the most. But in that time, we have seen increases in degrees granted at all levels. And again, looking at this by ethnicity, most ethnicities have seen increases in degrees earned, which are concurrent, obviously, with the enrollment increases. Notably, the number of degrees earned by Hispanic students has increased at a faster rate than enrollment of Hispanic students, which is really good news. So far, I have focused on our student metrics, but we have also seen success in strategic plan metrics for research and workforce development. As the board well knows, we achieved R1 status this year along with UNR. This slide shows our total research expenditures as they are reported to the NSF HERD survey, which is a major metric in determining R1 status. Research expenditures have increased 112% from fiscal year 2014 to 2018, and this was well ahead of our goal of $55 million by fiscal year 2018 and on pace for a $150 million goal by fiscal year 2025. However, much of this growth has been in our ability to better account for our internal research expenditures and not necessarily in external grant activity. The legislature's decision to not continue our funding for Health for Nevada initiative has obviously delayed our efforts to attract more external grants. So UNLV really does need to bring more research-intensive faculty to campus and to sustain this upward momentum. We also know that our salaries are below the R1 marketplace, which has led to difficulty in retaining some of the most productive research faculty. As part of our research mission, the Office of Undergraduate Research supports our students getting involved at an early stage through high-impact research-related activities. And we work hard to connect undergraduate students to research opportunities and to funding support.
President Mian?
Yes.
We have a question for Regent Krajcak.
President Miena, just if sorry to do this to you, could you go back one slide?
Yes.
And you had mentioned of the research expenditures that are reported to NSF that there was a certain percentage that was from internal. What is that percentage of the $83 million?
So if you look at FY19, 56 of those, that's FY18, 63 of those $83 million dollars were from external funding.
Okay.
The rest is the internal research expenditure count.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Okay, let me go back to...
Chickens. President Miena?
Yes.
Now, I know that, or I believe, if I remember correctly, the internal was just recently started to be counted at UNLV. Were the numbers changed going back to 14 and 15 to reflect what the internal would have been then, or that doesn't include much internal?
We didn't go backwards.
So which year that we're looking at here was the first to include the internal? Would that be FY18?
That would be 2018. Where we 2017.
Oh,
2017. Okay, where was I? Here, the undergrad. Okay, over the past 2 years, the office served 1,642 undergraduate researchers. This office is also offering professional development and career training workshops and events, including summer research boot camps for incoming freshmen. The university has also shown growth in our direct contributions to Southern Nevada's economy, with increases in our patents, disclosures, and new businesses started in the past 4 years. We've also seen a dramatic increase, as you can see, in the number of small businesses that are using our development center. This is an important part of being connected to our community and to do important work that it's a feedback loop with research all the time. Our Division of Educational Outreach continues to work. This is on the workforce development and in conjunction with employers to develop and implement company and business-specific training. Listed here are some of the programs that have been most in demand. I won't put you through my reading of them. You can look at them. But when we look at the high-demand occupations noted on NC Strategic Plan website, we see that we have significant growth in our colleges that train students in those areas. And for us, that is specifically education, engineering, and nursing. And you can see the percentage increase in enrollment in education, engineering, and nursing, especially quite high. We have seen an increase in degrees from those colleges. This degree growth is for all degree levels as well as certificates. We anticipate much more growth in the number of degrees granted in nursing due to recently increasing our capacity in our BSN program by 50%. So you're going to see the nursing one jump up significantly. Now,
Regent Del Carlo.
Question?
Thank you, President Miano. What's your secret sauce? Because we have a nursing shortage all over the state. So to have a 34% increase, what have you guys done differently to get that?
Well, there's a lot of students who come into pre-nursing, right? They don't all make it into the actual nursing program. It's a very, very competitive program. So we definitely have a lot of students who are interested in nursing, but the capacity that we have for not the pre-nursing, but the actual nursing it's limited. So that you have both the attrition of the pre-nursing students that don't go on and the fact that our capacity is limited, although we are just increasing that also through online programming.
Okay, thank you.
Now, changing gears a little bit, as our campus continues to grow in enrollment and its research mission, we are faced with what I really believe is a severe restriction in terms of the size of our physical plant. This slide is the conceptual drawing of our new engineering building, for which we still need an additional $20 million in matching funds to complete, to meet the needs of, as you saw, a rapidly expanding enrollment in engineering. Additionally, we are seeking a $4 million match in planning funds for an interdisciplinary science and technology building to expand our research mission. Another planning match for the Lee Business School Fine Arts Building. It sounds like we're like the Capital Improvement Project University, but I'm going to tell you why we are, because we are really severely out of space. We just need funds to expand and accommodate growth in the strategic areas on campus, and yet we're still facing more than $100 million in deferred maintenance. So I just want you to take a quick look at this slide. This square footage deficit that we're in is serious. Now, if you want to know how this is calculated, it's an ENSHE formula that looks at assignable square footage for the categories of classrooms and class labs, research space and study space. And, you know, there are different drivers for each of these categories. For classrooms and class labs, it's student FTE, research expenditures, number of library volumes for the other two, which is kind of a weird methodology. But the bottom line is that UNLV is out of space, which is why we keep on coming up with buildings, because it's problematic, and it's a problem that we're going to have to solve soon. So while we have some challenges on the campus that we continue to actively work to improve upon, I really do think it has been a remarkable year for UNLV. Demand for UNLV reached a record high on campus with, as you saw, nearly, well, you didn't see this, 13,000 applications for our new first-year class. Our enrollment hit a record high, reaching over 31,000 students. We're meeting our access mission as the share of minority students on our campus continues to grow and perform. So we achieved R1 status as our research expanded. And so I think we're moving in the right direction. I think we have an enormous amount of work to do. Those are still numbers we want to increase by a lot. But it feels really good to see it all moving where you want it to be going. That's it. I'll take any other questions if you have.
Regent Trachok, then Chancellor Riley.
I just have a comment. First of all, thank you very much for the excellent presentation. But also thank you for all of your efforts, untiring devotion to UNLV. The university and the system is very appreciative of all of that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Geddes. I'm going to echo some of the comments I made too at CSN. When this board adopted 2025 goals, they were very ambitious. And I was a little nervous at the time that they were being adopted, because I thought they're well thought out, but we really pushed the presidents to really push this issue of student success. And I can tell you from these presentations in a short period of time, those goals will be met. And I think most importantly is a change in discussion in Southern Nevada about knowing that we need more high-touch programs. We need to scale more of our programs up. We need more resources to do it. But when we have a board and presidents focused on the most important issue of student success, we can do amazing things. And it's not because of our diversity or that we have many of our students who are financially challenged, that becomes an excuse why we can have single-digit graduations at CSN and never hit 40% graduation rates at UNLV. This is last year we've hit a 4% increase in persistent rates. That is extraordinary. It's extraordinary because of focus, of effort, and saying that we can do better and that our diversity is not something that's an excuse for us not to move forward. So, I'm pretty amazed at just the progress that has been made in implementing these programs. I mean, from the workshop that we had on student success and talking about best practices and implementing those simple things of those alerts, calling students who aren't showing up and asking them why you aren't in class.
Yeah.
That's not a huge effort. But from that, by that simple phone call, we can direct students to financial aid, social services, to academic support. I'm very optimistic. I know when we adopted those goals, I was all there pushing, but I was nervous that we could actually achieve those for 2025, and we are. I mean, you look at these persistent rates these last couple of years, and this board's focus and the president's focused on student success, it's very impressive.
Thank you. Regent Hayes.
What he said, largely. One thing I did want to point out that I think maybe I've misunderstood through the years, or maybe we all have, I don't know, is while I want to start talking more about four-year graduation rates and hate that we always talk about six-year, I'm now going to talk about eight-year like you did. I was always under the impression that once kind of they hit 6 years, it was almost a negligible number. And we're talking about 20% more in that two-year window between six and 8 years actually got their degrees. And it could just be my misperception over these years, but I always just thought it was like, if they didn't do it in six, there was just a trickling. That's a pretty good number. Now, we'd like to close that
right.
and do it, but That is encouraging that we aren't necessarily losing everyone that doesn't graduate in the 6 years.
And I think importantly, it cues us not to give up on students who are taking longer. They may have different life circumstances, but even if their dream takes 8 years, it's still worth achieving.
And maybe there's things that we can do to help speed that up. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're pushing more 15 to finish, those types of things.
Right.
And just wanted to commend you and your team on, you know, we bring in student success summits and whatnot, and you hear what they say, and you've implemented some of these things. And, I mean, we're not going to do exactly what Georgia State or some of these other schools did. You find out what works for you. And obviously some of these you've implemented. Hopefully we'll do more in the future. But the numbers are very promising, so thank you. Oh, one thing I did want to ask about, there was a big drop in international students, it looked like, in the graduation and enrollment rates. What can we do, or can we ask Chancellor Riley to do, in working with our congressional delegation to find, I mean, as I understand, it's a problem nationally that
it is.
We're having a hard time getting international students to the country. What can we do to help have our congressional delegation help to open up those doors?
I had that conversation with them in September because it's kind of being nationally recognized that that international students are not coming at the same rates. Now, there are organizations that you can partner with. We're investigating a number of those options, organizations that focus on international student recruitment. And we're investigating a number of those possibilities at the moment.
Be careful with those. I don't know if you saw the story about Kansas the other day, that they partnered with a group and spent lots of money, and it actually went down over the five-year period.
Oh, okay.
Vice Chair Dubrava.
Thank you, Chair Geddes. President Miana, I just want to reiterate what Regent Trachok and even Regent Hayes alluded to. Thank you for this presentation. Thank you and your team for the efforts that have gone into these results.
Thank you very much.
Hannah?
So obviously UNLV is known for diversity, and that's a major part of who we are as far as ethnic diversity, but it doesn't stop there because a huge proportion of our students are non-traditional students who maybe this isn't, you know, right after high school that they even started their degrees, and they work full-time or maybe multiple jobs or maybe their parents and grandparents, and that's very common. Those are people that I have classes with every semester, and it's very normal and it's amazing, but it also means that maybe it does take them 7 years. I met somebody the other day who you might look at her and think, oh, you're probably, you know, a four-year senior, just got out of, you know, high school and come right over here, but she's been here for 7 years and she's ready to go, and it's like that's totally normal and absolutely supported by UNLV. I personally am in my fifth year, and I am very proud of that fact, and I know everybody that I ever tell is very supportive of that, and there has been a huge shift in those 5 years that I've been here of very high self-awareness of UNLV and realizing that that is a fact, and there's no need to fight that. There's no need to funnel students in a way that maybe doesn't work for them, but they will eventually get there. And we see that very often. And maybe it does take 8 years, but after those 8 years, that's one more person with a degree, which is amazing. And so I personally just, I really want to say thank you to President Miana and this entire administration for keeping that in mind and making it a huge priority, because it's become very clear to the student body. So thank you.
Thank you, Hannah.
Thank you, Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair Geddes. I just want to say to my colleagues, too, thank you so much for doing such a great job, and you have really made a difference, and it's so appreciated. And thank you to Regent Hayes for asking the question about the 8-year graduation rate, because we all have a story, and
yeah.
It took me 11 years, and it was a situational thing, but I never lost sight of the fact that I wanted a bachelor's degree, and I moved overseas for 6 years as a military spouse and just chipped away. And 11 years later, I finally had my bachelor's degree. And the one thing about a degree for all you students out there, once you get that degree, nobody can take it away, and just keep learning. So thank you for making a difference.
Thank you, Regent Del Carlo.
Regent Lieberman.
Risk of letting Regent Dubrava tell my story, I graduated after 16 years with 210 credits. Everybody helped me get into UNLV. Very few people until Dr. Esther Langston in the social work department sat me down and got me to graduate, helped me get in. We have made, helped me get out. We have made so much progress in the last decades and merging with workforce and working with advisors and doing everything right in this regard. It's really a positive, wonderful thing.
Regent Del Carlo.
Sorry, Chair Gaze. I just have to ask Regent Lee Marin, did they have the XX credit fee in those days, too, if you had over 200 credits?
No, but they were very happy to take my out-of-state tuition because I didn't have a driver's license to prove that I was a Nevada resident for the first 6 years that I lived here.
Vice President Vaughk has taken a note, and she will be backbilling Regent Lee Marin. Seeing no other questions, thank you very much for the presentation and the information. I want to give a thank you to UNLV for hosting this meeting. Specifically, I'd like to thank President Miana and from the President's office, Arianna Triansky, Rosita Chapman, Fred Tredup from the Student Union, Ashley Annan, Kirsten Dimmick, the Advanced Services team, from Information Technology, Steve Christensen, from Audiovisual, Danny Chandler, Rick Romero, Claudio Osanaga, James Bigelow, Mark Dudzik. From Technical Support, Tim Shupp, C.C. Perialis, James Unfried, Bentley Holmes-Gull, Ed Boog, Gar Casale. From Catering, Mary Tennis and the UNLV Catering staff. From Security, the UNLV Police Department, especially appreciated you yesterday afternoon. From DRI Reno, President Acharya, Ira Stewart, Ryan Coots, and A.J. Wolf for accommodating our current renovations, also for all the support up in Great Basin College for always being there, as well as our terrific staff, Carrie, Angela, Winter, Jennifer, and Dean. Thank you all very much for making this meeting go so well. We're now going to go to item number 25, development of a conservation easement on the Main Station Field Laboratory. President Johnson, and I just want you to know, you're between us and lunch.
Such encouragement. Thank you, Chair Geddes, and all of the regents. I don't think this is going to take 30 minutes because this is for information only. It's an update. It was a controversial item back in June of 2018. To actually sell parcels on our Main Station Field Laboratory, which we call the University Farm. And in that meeting, we all agreed that we could sell a 104-acre parcel, a 40-acre parcel, if we would put the remaining 771 acres under a conservation easement. We did sell the 104-acre parcel for $18 million. Those funds have been distributed and accounts set up for, according to the memorandum of understanding between the Dean of Agriculture and the President of the University, which was mandated in the June decision-making. So that's all been done. The 40-acre parcel remains yet for sale, and it's with a broker for marketing. So I want to just concentrate on the update on moving toward a conservation easement on that 771 acres. Right after the June meeting, we contracted with Resource Concepts Incorporated, I'll refer to as RCI, and in this board material, I put in the agreement that we have with RCI and the scope of work in five parts. They were going to facilitate a public meeting to talk about what the community would be interested in terms of conservation easement. That meeting was held on October 9th of 2018. Secondly, they were to give us a template for a conservation easement contract, as they have been involved in several negotiations for conservation easements. They did give us that general template for a conservation easement contract, which we shared with the regents at a later meeting. The third item is where we're really now getting down to work, and that is to help us specifically design contract language that distinguishes the rights that we want to sell in a conservation easement contract and the rights we want to retain so that we can continue agricultural and natural resource research, extension, and education. So what that required, of course, is that we had to hear from agriculture what they intended to do for the next 1,000 years on the farm, and that required a farm plan. And that took about a year. So we received the farm plan from the College of Agriculture in September, and we called RCI back now to work on the specifics of the conservation easement contract. What the farm plan told us was that they want to put the whole 771 acres under a conservation easement, but there are certain areas where they want to be able to retain buildings. We call it Dairy Hill, we call it the meat plant area, and some housing for farm staff. That will not be in the, well, it'll be in the conservation easement, but we will retain the rights to have buildings there. And the farm plan identified that through time, they would anticipate having 650 acres upon which to do research, teaching, and outreach for agriculture and natural resources work. So 650 acres is very important because that is the amount of water that we need to provide. It was clear to us from RCI that if you're going to be able to sell a conservation easement or sell some rights, those rights you retain have to have enough water to carry out the mission of the conservation easement. So RCI is going to come back in January and give us language distinguishing the rights that we want to sell versus what we want to keep, and write into the conservation easement contract an obligation that the university will be able to supply enough water to fulfill the agricultural research, extension, and education missions on that 650 acres. We do not want to put the water into the conservation contract where we're selling the water. We want to just guarantee that we will be able to supply water forever on this farm so that we can fulfill the agricultural missions that are identified. Then I want to talk about water in particular. Another part of the materials that we put in the board packet has to do with the contract that we have with the City of Reno to receive treated effluent water from the water treatment plant of Reno. So the water treatment plant in Reno is located very near the farm. So way back in the year 2000, the City of Reno came to the university and said, we need to get rid of treated effluent water somewhere, and your farm looks like a great place to do so. There's a lot of research to say that treated effluent water is quite safe for crops. So since 2000, the city has invested in water, in pipelines to get the water to the farm, and they also gave us the water distribution or the irrigation systems for the farm. So we have been using treated effluent water on the farm since the year 2000. The contract says we will continue to receive that water for 50 years, another 31 years, with an option to extend for another 50 years. So it very neatly covers the entire 2000 century. So the only way they can not give us this water is to give us a 5-year notice that they're either going to close or substantially reduce the size of that water treatment plant. So we'll have plenty of notice on how to do that. But a conservation easement is for perpetuity, so we need to be able to guarantee that we will retain enough water to supply water to fulfill the agricultural missions on the farm beyond this century. And with the 650-acre identification of land to be potentially irrigated, at the standard rate of 4 acre-feet per acre, which is on the farm now, that requires that we retain 2,600 acre-feet of water in the ownership of the university so that we can supply that to the farm if we ever lose this effluent water. The amendment, the first amendment to this contract with the city is really important because that's the amendment that identifies that we will take up to 2,200 acre-feet per acre from the city. We can take more, but we need to take up to 2,200 acre-feet of effluent water, which they are supplying today. So that's why we don't want to put all of this water in the conservation easement contract because we have a couple of sources of water. One is the water that we water rights that we already own. The other is the augmented water rights that really come to us, and not water rights, but it's water coming to us of 2,200 acre-feet. At the 4 acre-feet per acre standard, 2,200 acres will cover 550 acres of the water that we need. So basically, we have put the calculations in here that we own 3,844 acre-feet of water. We have to retain 2,600 acre-feet of water. So we've got about 1,244 acre-feet of excess property here or excess water that we need to figure out what to do with. Now, we would lean towards selling some of our excess property, as we have been doing on land properties, in order to use it for high-end purposes for the university. But if we do so, of course, we would bring any sale contract back to the regents for decision-making. Just to close here, we are going to meet with RCI, the consulting firm, in January. We have asked them to bring us the language of the contract on rights distribution and the language on the contract of how to guarantee that we will be able to supply the 2,600 acre-feet of water to support this support the mission of this conservation easement. If we can get this language agreed upon in January, we will bring the language of the conservation easement contract to the board in March. Then it will be a decision item as to whether or not the structure of that contract is acceptable to the regents. And then if it is, then we go back to RCI, and the final two elements of their contract is to help us find an appraiser to appraise the value of a conservation easement contract, and the final element is to help us market that conservation easement contract. And if and when we get the conservation easement contract sold, then we will bring that sale back to the regents yet again for final decision.
Any questions or comments? Good job. At this point, we will recess until 11:20 for lunch. And at 11:20, we will go to item number 26. Oh, I'm sorry, Regent Pace. Sorry.
I'm a little confused. What was the conservation easement that came before us? I know it was very controversial. We got a lot of mumbo jumbo in here, and I'd be really curious to go back to those minutes to see what we 100% agreed upon when we did that. And I'm not sure that's outlined properly in here. So I'd like to request that gets sent to the full board, a comparison between this memo and what we agreed last time.
Will do.
Thank you.
Sorry, were you going to add something, President Jones? Were you going to say something, or were you?
Well, I can. Memorandum of understanding that memorialized those elements that were required from the June 18 meeting was distributed to the regents, and we have distributed the funds from the $18 million sale of the 104 acres exactly like the memo that that we develop. But so it's the exact same distribution that was required in the June 2018 meeting.
We will get the minutes out to the full board. Regent Page. Okay. We will recess for lunch and come back at 11:25. The board will come back to order. We are on item number 26, the Nishi Foster Youth Success Initiative. Chancellor Riley.
Thank you, Chairman Geddes. As requested, when the board passed their waiver program for foster youth, we were requested to come back a year later to update the board on the progress of the program. And with that, I'm going to turn this over to Laura Forbes, our NCHI Foster Care Youth Ambassador. And I do want to remind the board that this position was funded from the Walter S. Johnson Foundation, and we'll hear from them shortly on some additional support that they're offering for this initiative. Thank you.
And just one second, Laura. I do want to note for the record that we did receive some letters of support for this initiative from the Nevada Department of Health and Human Services, the Whittier Trust, Washoe County Human Services Agency, the Nevada Department of Education, the Monroe Schuller Foundation, and the Legal Center. Okay, Laura.
Yes, thank you. All right, I'm going to get right to it because we got a few people speaking. In September 2018, the board launched the system-wide NCHI Foster Youth Success Initiative with the passage of the Foster Youth Fee Waiver. NCHI then received a $200,000 grant from the Walter S. Johnson Foundation to support the successful implementation of the initiative, which seeks to more effectively recruit, support, and retain students who have been in foster care. This grant is being used to increase utilization of the fee waiver and other forms of financial aid, design and coordinate campus-based support services, and build stronger career pathways. In order to achieve this, a portion of the grant is allocated toward my position as the new statewide foster youth ambassador. Since I started in July, one of my initial efforts has been to assist the institutions in developing thorough processes for effectively identifying and serving students who have been in foster care. Michael and I are also partnering with Clark County DFS and Project WE on a branding and implementation plan for the fee waiver and a complimentary mentorship piece. And we are collaborating with the Governor's Office of Workforce Innovation and Workforce Connections to increase federal WIOA funding for college-enrolled foster youth. I also launched a website for the initiative and recently started a Twitter account for the first time in my life to help with outreach. And at Chancellor Riley's request, I organized and recruited foster youth students to participate in one of two roundtable discussions where the Chancellor heard directly from them about the education barriers they face and their input on support needed. I have included their feedback in the meeting materials. I also hosted a statewide retreat alongside a professional facilitator. Over 30 school and community providers, as well as 5 students, participated to build a more cohesive statewide community focused on supporting foster youth post-secondary education attainment. The retreat produced a strategic plan with clearly identified 1-, 3-, and 5-year initiative goals. I then took an NCHI delegation to the Blueprint Conference in LA, which focused on foster youth post-secondary education success. And as we work to expand the initiative, I am supporting TMCC and UNLV in applying for Walter S. Johnson Foundation grants, which, if approved, will be used to bolster foster youth support services on their campuses. I'm also working with the institutions to more precisely and efficiently identify and verify currently enrolled foster youth for the purposes of accurately tracking key data, increasing utilization of the fee waiver, and connecting students to campus-based support services, regardless of their fee waiver eligibility. As part of that effort, I wrote language for a foster care history identification question that was recently approved, disseminated, and will soon be added to all of the admissions applications per the Chancellor's request. Over the past few months, I have discovered that we need a more robust processes for verifying foster care history for students who indicate that status on their FAFSA or through other means. Currently, only students who know about and successfully apply for the fee waiver are asked for documentation. So I'm working with the institutions to develop a more comprehensive process for following up with every single student who indicates they may have foster care history. As As of my presentation materials submission date, we have identified 266 enrolled potential foster youth across the entry system. Since I submitted my materials, CSN has added one verified foster youth who is receiving the fee waiver, but out of the 266, only 77 have been officially verified as having foster care history, and out of those 77, only 66 are currently receiving the waiver. Therefore, we need to work on identifying and verifying the additional 189 students across the state. In fall 2019, our institutions have collectively spent $129,059 on the fee waiver, which is slightly higher than the original estimate. However, that estimate of $115,000 was based on the originally proposed beginning eligibility age of 16, and the board approved a change to include students who were in care at age 14 or 15. I would like to thank our funder, Yali Lincroft, for providing the financial and technical support necessary to jumpstart the initiative. I would also like to thank Chancellor Riley and the board for championing this effort. Finally, I would like to thank everyone else who has supported this initiative from its inception. Senator Kinsella, Michael and my teammates, our WIOA consultant, Sean Hughes, our retreat facilitator, Leslie Murdoch, the foster youth champions at each of the institutions, and our amazing community partners. There are at least 20 folks who physically showed up today, either in public comment or during the presentation statewide, and many others have submitted support letters. And most importantly, I would like to thank all of the foster care alumni students who have provided their imperative and candid expertise, especially the two speaking today, Jewel and Evalera, as we work to make this initiative stronger. And then we'll go to Valerie up in Washoe.
Just a quick question.
Regent Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. What's the Twitter handle?
Sorry, can you repeat that?
What's the Twitter handle?
At NG Foster Youth. So follow me. I need friends.
Okay.
So Valerie, whenever you're ready.
Hello, my name is Valerie Welsh, and I'm the Independent Living Specialist here in Washoe County for the Human Service Agency, where I have been a social worker and a licensed social worker here in Nevada, working with foster teens in our system for over 16 years. You and our class of 93. I also want to say that I oversee our court jurisdiction programming and our voluntary services that we offer to foster youth in the system from ages 18 to 21. So I would like to start by expressing my gratitude today to the Board of Regents for passing this initiative and the tuition fee waiver. I'd like to express that the youth utilizing this program on my caseload are currently able to use their tuition for things like buying a used car that might remove barriers to getting to school, or working less hours at their part-time jobs in order to supplement time that they need to be spending on their schoolwork. I'm equally passionate about the youth that are over the age of 21 and have aged off of my caseload. As many of you know, when youth are aging out of the foster care system, they are just trying to get their footing. They are navigating how to live independently, pay rent, secure jobs, find reliable transportation, in addition to addressing their trauma and many of them their mental health. Some of them are also parenting, as I have Avalera here today, who's one of my former youth. Many of these youth are not ready to explore post-secondary education when they turn 18 because the services, and they need that time, and their services end with Washoe County and the rest of the state agencies at age 21. Many of them feel the pressures of enrolling early in school, trying to achieve as many credits as possible because they lose their support at 21. By implementing the tuition fee waiver for foster youth until age 26, we've now been able to extend our education and training voucher scholarship as well to 26, which has given an entire group of young people the opportunity to either continue their educational pursuits that they've already started prior to age 21, in addition to open up the opportunity for those young people just finding their stability at age 22 or 23, the opportunity to get started. I also want to express that me and my colleagues at Washoe County Human Services do not take enrolling in post-secondary education lightly. We work diligently with our youth to determine their readiness and the best plan for them as they are graduating from high school or achieving their high school equivalency. We recognize that their FAFSA eligibility and their tuition fee waiver come with an expectation of a 2.0 GPA, and we want them to be able to continue to take advantage of this wonderful opportunity. I have been lucky to also be part of the TMCC Foster Youth Support Team since its development 8 years ago as the vision of Dr. Rachel Solnasas. We are committed in that work group to continue to provide supports to foster youth on campus and continue to come up with creative ideas not only to get foster youth excited about attending college, but also to work on ways to help support them so that we see greater retention rates. We are also committed at Human Services to continue our involvement with Laura Oberson and the NG work groups to support those youth that are either on the waiver or getting onto the waiver program. Lastly, I would like to thank Yali Lincroft and the Walter S. Johnson Foundation. For years, they have provided funding to support educational programming for youth in Washoe County with the hope to prepare them for the post-secondary education that we all want them to achieve. Thank you for having me today.
Thank you, Valerie. We'll go to Tim Birch at Clark County Department of Family Services now.
Good morning, Board of Regents. Tim Birch, Human Services Administrator for Clark County, Nevada, responsible not only for the Child Welfare Service Array, but also the Adult Social Service Array and Office of the Ombudsman. And through that blended service array, we've been able to work with our young folks who are aging out. I'm thankful to my staff and team that have been working diligently prior to this waiver, but have really ramped up efforts. And thank you to our Board of County Commissioners who have recently allocated revenue from our marijuana business tax license fees to ensure that our young people who are accessing this waiver, who are not a part of the aged out foster care system, who already get ongoing supports, have access to supports. We've been able to, with that economic and workforce development security revenue that recently came down through an 8-cent sales tax as well, be able to carve out dollars for young people who will be going through this NSHE waiver program. And we've been talking to the chancellor to make sure that we're providing not only the case management supports, but be able to make a declaration on behalf of Clark County that we will be able to work with all of the young people accessing this waiver to ensure that they will not experience homelessness while they go through this program, and we'll be able to walk with them up into the age of 24 through our youth system and through our adult system until they graduate and exhaust a waiver at 26. And not only through housing supports, but also with some economic and workforce development to make sure that they have the opportunity to be able to articulate the skills they're gaining here through this system in the workforce environment as well. So we're really thankful for the type of work that's been done. I just want to highlight the success of our partnership with Laura and her team, that we're doing things that not only work for young people, but include them. So just real quick on the Project We and the branding initiative, it shouldn't be underscored that this isn't just a marketing campaign. This is a mentoring program that works with young people who will develop this brand, that will develop the program. They will marshal this ad campaign themselves. So they're getting real-world experience as a part of that and hope that they go on to become alumni of the hotel and business school here as well. So with that, I just thank you, and I'm available for any questions if you have them.
Chancellor Riley?
I just wanted to comment on thank you, Mr. Birch, and to Chairwoman Marilyn Kilpatrick and, yes, and the Board of County Commissioners that are actually setting aside funds of their homeless to ensure that every youth who's in foster care has housing or to help pay for their dorm. And that's huge because, you know, when this board passed the tuition assistance program, that was only part of the picture. This actually provides the housing piece. So thank you to the chairwoman and the board and yourself for working with us to ensure that all our foster care youth have housing while they're in higher education.
Absolutely. And thank you, Chancellor. And again, just to reiterate, not just the idea that we're going to write a check and leave them and hope that they can figure it out, but we've extended the service of our case management through our Step Up program. And we look at that data. Foster youth are traditionally far more likely to wind up homeless within 2 years of exiting a system. Through the work we've been able to do, we've been able to decrease that national rate of over 20% to less than 2% here in Clark County, Nevada. So with that type of success and that type of team partnering with this phenomenal NSHE system, we know that we're going to be able to make real-world change for these young people in short order. So thank you.
Regent Lieberman.
This program was brought to us by Chancellor Riley, Michael Flores, and a number of other people who have been committed to our kids in Nevada for decades. But we need to let our funders and our students know that this program has to live on beyond any of us or beyond this board. It is vital to our system, it is vital to our community, and it is vital to our kids' lives and what they do beyond this experience is going to be life-changing for the entire community.
Thank you. I don't think Michael's been here for decades, but just on planet Earth.
Thank you, Tim. Next, we're going to have Yali Linkoff from the Walter S. Johnson Foundation.
I've been told everybody likes my outfit. So it's such a pleasure to be here with all of you. A year ago, you did a historic occasion of not only supporting the Chancellor's initiative, but actually one-upping it by adding the additional support to children that's been adopted. So since that time, I just want to say it's been a pleasure working in Nevada because you don't walk, you run. You do things in such an amazing coordinated fast fashion, because I guess, again, you guys are, it's a young state that just runs. I'll use the example of putting in the information in the application so you can self-identify it as a foster youth. It took us 5 years to do in California. I think you guys took 5 months. So thank you for being willing to take that leadership role as a system and a state. I also want to thank the public partners that have spoken before, and that includes the partners in WASO. I'm saying hello to Valerie over there. And the team that had done, I want to share a little bit about the grant we gave to them earlier, which had hired college students at the medical school to tutor high school students in the foster care system. It was a multiple win-win, and you will never meet such enthusiastic high school students that want to go to your campus. So this is the type of partnership that has people testifying from the students to the chancellor to the public official to a foundation like me. You make my job easy, and I am grateful to be a partner of this. I just want to say that as we continue this work and expanding it, absolutely what the chancellor said about leveraging resources for homeless dollars, for work opportunity. I know your job is difficult as regents where you have multiple demands and limited resources. And I really feel like what's lovely about this program is this is a discrete population where you can learn best practice and from there leverage it to all the other students that you have needs for. First generation, undocumented, they're all, you know, these concurrent circle of what are you today? I mean, you're a student, but you may have multiple needs. By tackling the hardest population, which is the foster youth, you learn so much lessons from everything else, and you are able to leverage those public funds that this is the best place to spend the money. I'm sure that Tim would be very happy if he didn't have a job and there were fewer foster youth. And so for you, allowing the students to be educated, employed, you're doing that part with them. So again, thank you for the everyone here. And I just, again, you make my job easy because clearly there's partnership and public-private works when we all work together. Thank you.
Ms. Linkoff, on behalf of the entire board, thank you. I mean, you and your foundation have made this possible, and we look forward to a long partnership. Thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you, Yali. And now we're going to move into the part I'm most excited about, which is to hear from our students. So first we have Jewel for the Southern Nevada representation.
Hi, my name is Jewel, UNLV for Fine Arts, and my concentration is within painting. I entered foster care shortly before I turned 18, which was a boat-rocking experience for me. However, it led me down a college path that I didn't previously expect would be an option for me in the first place. Before college, I was originally planning to enter the workforce right away because I needed to take care of my family. But after entering the foster care system and meeting my step-up worker, Jasmine Rodriguez, I've learned about the fee waiver, and now here I am at my college, UNLV. Because of the fee waiver, I now get to go to college and get to be the first person in my family to get a college degree, something I never imagined, but here I am. Thanks to you guys. The fee waiver has been a blessing for me, but my biggest challenge with transitioning to college was the lack of knowledge amongst UNLV staff in the foster care and the lack of coordination between departments. These issues are a never-ending record for me as a foster youth, having to re-explain myself and my situation week after week, which is pretty tiresome and stressful. I fear that I would not be able to continue my plan to attend college due to these struggles. In the future, I hope UNLV can hire someone who specializes in working with the foster youth so other foster youth like me don't have to deal with the frustrations that I had to deal with. Aside from these issues, the fee waiver has created a path for me to success. I hope the Board of Regents, UNLV, and other Nevada colleges will continue to support the fee waiver moving forward, as well as on-campus support services that Statewide Initiative is seeking to establish.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jewel. And now we'll go to Avalera up in Washoe County.
Hi, my name is Avalera, and it is my pleasure to be present here today. I am on my last year of the criminal justice program at TMCC. I aged out of foster care at the age of 18, and after I was in the system for 7 years. During those years, I did experience some hardships, such as figuring out how to adhere to the strict rules in an oppressive environment and living in survival mode, rather than having the focus on being a kid. Transitioning out of foster care was kind of like the hardest part because I had to learn how to function in Reno's fast community. I became a young mom to my two boys, and that brought me a lot of motivation to be able to succeed and better our future. I really want to thank you today for the fee waiver. It has been a huge financial help that has impacted me in a positive way. I am able to complete my associate's degree. The only thing that I would like to mention is that the degree has made a big difference. However, being a parent and maintaining consistent childcare has been an issue and a worry for me. I figured that that would get better once my children go to preschool. However, I feel that I may struggle with daycare at some point, and I feel like it isn't realistic for me to finish my degree by the age of 26. I will finish my associate's, but not my bachelor's. So I do feel that because former foster years have such a hard time transitioning into adulthood due to the challenges that come with being raised in the system, the current fee waiver eligibility age limit is somewhat difficult for all of us that are trying to, grow into adulthood, and I do feel that I would like to kindly and respectfully request that the board considers raising the fee waiver eligibility age. That way, it would allow foster youth like me the chance to be able to finish their bachelor's degree. And again, I'd like to thank you, and it's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Thank you, and I will add, as Regent McAdoo is always good to point out, as the 13 of us are here to serve all of you, so if you need anything, you let us know or you let anybody on your campus know, the presidents, the administrators, we're here to support you and make sure you have success, both of you, and spread the word to all your friends.
Thank you, Avalera. And then do we have Senator Kinsella?
She's hiding in the back.
Yay! Okay. So we're going to close with Senator Kinsella, and thank you again to all of you for your time.
Thank you. Good morning. I don't think we're quite at afternoon yet. It is really, I'm only here to do something that we don't get told a lot as elected officials, which is to show a deep expression of gratitude to you all as a board for having the vision not only to say that this was a good idea, but to really give the support necessary to the system and to our institutions to see it through. It is a tremendous, tremendous thing that we have students who are not only already taking advantage of the program, but are preparing to take advantage of the program next year and for years to come. And to all of our university staff and our college staff who have made sure, and all of our leadership, who have made sure that this program is a success on campus, what we have functionally done is create a home base for students who haven't had one maybe ever. And I'm so proud that it's our system of higher education that's doing that. So on behalf of myself and the entire legislature, thank you so much. And please know that there's a commitment to continue working together, not only on the issues that affect our foster youth, but on all sorts of other issues. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Closing words?
So again, I want to say thank you. You know, 2 to 9% of kids who graduate from foster care actually end up getting a degree. Those numbers are going to change in Nevada. And thank you again for all our partners, too, for the Walter S. Johnson Foundation for actually expanding our ability at UMC and TMCC to help build that incredible support, and our partners in Clark County, Washoe County, and the legislature, and all the child advocacy groups. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll go on to item number 27, Procedures and Guideline Manual Revisions, Differential Fee Programs. We'll start with Nevada State College. President Patterson.
Thank you, Chair Geddes. I'll have Vice President Butler present the item. We also have the Associate Dean Latricia Perry from Nursing here as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Kevin Butler, Nevada State College. So we've had a differential fee in nursing programs since 2015. With that, we were able to double the size of our program, or excuse me, triple the size of our program. Better get that right. The majority of those fees are used to hire additional faculty, including the lab faculty, the clinical faculty, and we haven't increased that rate since the 2015 establishment. So obviously there's been a number of salary increases that have occurred since then. We're also going to staff and equip a simulation lab in the new Health Sciences Center at CSN. And so we did a budget analysis recently about how we're going to manage all those costs. And we started looking at what the current registration fee is, because that's how we established this differential fee in the beginning. And the analysis seems to support increasing to that rate and then holding to HEPI so that we're kind of reflective of the predictable price scenarios that we've done with all of our other fees. And so that's where we're at right now, and I'm happy to answer any questions related to that.
Do I have a motion to approve the change in the nursing differential fee at Nevada State College? Motion from Regent Lieberman, second from Regent McMichael. Any questions or comments on that one? And this is all but the BN RSN, which will come, yeah. RN to BSN,
RN
which will
BSN.
Come later. All in favor signify by saying aye. All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously.
Great, thank you.
We'll go to Truckee Meadows Community College. President Hilgerson.
President Hilgerson, for the record, I think I can cover this quickly, so if you don't mind, I'll just sit here, if that's okay with the chair. So at TMCC, we have started a Bachelor of Science in Dental Hygiene. And one of the fun facts is our so-called two-year degree program, which is on its way out, was only 11 credits shy of what was required for a Bachelor of Science degree. So as we complete the last of our two-year degree completers and move all of the dental hygiene students to the Bachelor of Science degree program, it made sense to have to correct the differential fee. So what will happen now is the $88 and a little bit of change per credit will be the differential fee for all of the courses in the Bachelor of Science of Dental Hygiene. However, it does replace some of the lab fees that had been connected to many courses. There will still be two courses. I think one is 100 and one is 200 level that will still have a lab fee in addition to the differential fee. But for the most part, what the faculty and staff decided was it made a lot more sense to have a very streamlined approach to funding this program, the consumables and some of the salaries for the instructional aides and other related costs. So that is the rationale, and it's a really wonderful program with an incredible new space thanks to the Pennington Foundation. It's also the program that partners with Adopt a Vet, and we are giving free dental services through the Adopt a Vet program at our campus on a weekly basis. It's wonderful. So I'm open for questions. Thank you.
Do I have a motion to approve the dental hygiene special course from Regent Del Carlo, second from Regent Perkins? Any questions or comments? All in favor, signify by saying aye. All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Now we'll go to UNR, the proposal to implement the $50 per credit fee for CHS.
Thank you, Chair Geddes. We do have our Dean of Community Health Sciences available, Dr. Trudy Larson, but I would particularly like to have you hear from some students that will be affected by the fee. In general, this $50 per credit hour fee, which will go into effect in the fall of 2020, 60% of which would go into instructional support for additional lecturers and individuals to staff the labs, some software for internships and equipment, and tutors for specific classes. And those tutor positions will create jobs for graduate students in addition to some graduate assistant positions. 15% would go to student financial aid as required by Regents for registration fees, other support services for recruiting admission, career services, as well as curricular assessment, and then 10% to support some professional development activities such as travel to professional meetings for graduate students. I would like to, at the Chair's permission, call on Davis Florence, who is an undergraduate student in majoring in kinesiology, and also Rachel Kaiser, who got her BS degree in this college and is currently a graduate student in the Master of Public Health program. If we could get Davis and Rachel, who are sitting there in Reno.
Ladies first.
Chairman Geddes, Vice Chairman DeBrava, Regents. My name is Rachel Kaiser, and as mentioned, I am a first-year public health student in the master's program in an epidemiology track. On behalf of the graduate members of the School of Community Health Sciences Student Council, it's my pleasure today to speak in favor of the differential fee proposal. As aspiring researcher and researchers and public health practitioners, we feel that the addition of this fee to upper division credits would provide graduate students in our school with exceptional opportunity to foster research and development skills. Having the ability to apply for research and conference funding would allow pursuit of unique projects, challenging innovative thinking and inspiring a new lens to view public health issues. Additionally, the instructional support would diversify learning and aid in maximizing our student experiences. Replacing the current laboratory fees would provide more stable funding for laboratory staff and equipment. Having graduated from the undergraduate CHS kinesiology program, I know the exceptional value added to the degree due to these extensive and hands-on laboratory experiences. Further enhancing these labs would be a great asset to the curriculum and the development of students. The creation of new needs-based financial aid assistance for both graduates and undergraduates promotes equity in education and offers support to those with limited means while pursuing their degrees. In addition to this, the inclusion of graduate employment opportunities, such as assistantships and tutoring services in funding allocation, would create a more cohesive environment between our faculty, students, and staff. Finally, it is our opinion that the funding structure of the proposed differential fee is set up to directly benefit students and continue improving and expanding the School of Community Health Sciences. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, Chairman Geddes, Vice Chairman DeBrava, and Regents. My name is Davis Florence, and I'm a senior studying community health sciences at the University of Nevada. During my time in this program, I have seen tremendous growth. I have witnessed community health sciences become an independent school on campus. I have seen the school grow to be one of the largest in Nevada, with the public health and kinesiology tracks being one of the most desired programs by incoming students in the fall 2019 class. With this tremendous growth, I've also seen the severe importance of creating additional funding for my beloved school. From personal experience in classes, I have noticed the increase in enrollment size that puts our classes above the desired student-to-faculty ratio. With the proposed differential fee, more than $500,000 would go to be used for instructional support that includes the hiring of full-time faculty. This would directly help the student or the School of Community Health Sciences approach the goal of an 18-to-1 student-to-faculty ratio that is outlined in the UNR capacity study. Another benefit of this instructional support would provide funding for the numerous labs that are offered throughout my curriculum. I've been a teaching assistant for 6 classes, and I know how important it is to have the appropriate consumables for labs and new technology. As we are aspiring health workers, we are better prepared for professional lives post-graduation once we are able to train and experience these real-life devices used by a current health system. as the school has grown, it has not received the financial backing to enhance professional development. This has limited research opportunities, the ability for students and faculty to travel to educational conferences, and the number of graduate assistantships offered. These are all areas that, with the approval of the proposal, would be improved for everyone affiliated with the School of Health Sciences. On behalf of myself, ASU and Senators Prempeh, Donahue, and Komanduri, along with many of my undergraduate peers, we have full confidence that our faculty will use this differential fee to best serve our students and fully support the approval of the proposal. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you. Do I have a motion for approval? Motion from Regent Dubrava, second from Regent McMichael. Any questions or comments? Regent Hayes.
Yeah, I just have a real problem with this, as well as the one on the business school that's coming up. We spent a lot of time in the last year looking at tuition and capping how much we're going to grow tuition. And this just seems like a thumb in the eye to us of an end around to say, yeah, we know that you as a board said your policy is to cap tuition. And we went through a long process. It was, you know, Crystal's team, Vice Chancellor Abba's team did a lot of work on this. The campuses did a lot of work. And this is just saying, yeah, I know you guys told us that we want to cap tuition, but we're not going to do it, and we're going to do a big end-around on it. And it also sets up a two-tiered system to where we're telling our students that if you want to go into these very highly sought-after programs, then you're going to have to pay more money. But what does that say to our first-generation students who we know already have a lot of price sensitivity? Are we going to create a two-tiered system at our schools where, you know, rich kids from wealthy families are going to be able to go into certain programs and poorer kids aren't? I mean, the way the university system's been set up in this country for hundreds of years is it's the same price. We differentiate it significantly more at graduate school levels, but at the undergraduate level, it's been the same price whether you're getting a degree in literature or in business, and I think this really deviates from that. I think it's an end around our cap on tuition increases, and I'm there's no way I can support this.
Thank you, and I would just counter that this is exactly why we created it, was the high expense programs, so that all the students throughout the university weren't paying for the high expense programs, and I will be supporting it. Regent Perkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would just like to say when I went to school back here, when I went to school here 3 or 4 years ago, to get my bachelor's degree, I paid fees to take the computer class. There was always a fee for the extra. So this isn't anything new or different, but it's just the more expensive classes require a little bit more upfront fees.
Mr. Chair, if I could, this is significantly different. This isn't a $35 lab fee. This is a $50 a credit hour fee for all of your courses in this major. I understand if you've got a certain lab and it's, hey, it's $50, or if you look through, there was a program, I think it was the International Gaming Institute, added $2,300 for a trip to Asia. Yeah, there's travel expenses to go to Asia. This is changing the cost of a degree. This isn't, hey, this one class has a lab or has extra materials charge of $35, $50, $100. This is $50 a credit hour. This is creating a haves and have-not system in our university. We are turning the university system upside down. It's a profound change we should not make lightly. And to just say it's something we've always done is not reading this the way it is presented or the way it's going to be impacting our schools.
We will go to a roll call vote. Dean Gould.
I had a feeling that was coming. Okay. So first we start with Regent Dubrava.
Yes.
Chair Geddes.
Aye.
Regent Hayes. No. Regent Lieberman.
Yes.
Regent McAdoo.
No.
Regent McMichael.
Yes.
Regent Moran.
Yes.
Regent Page. Regent Perkins.
No.
Regent Trachuk.
Yes.
Regent Carter.
No.
Regent Carvalho.
No.
Regent Del Carlo.
No.
Motion fails.
Yep. Now we will go on to the differential fee for the College of Business. President Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Geddes.
I'm sorry. Just 1 second, President Johnson. In accordance with the Ethics and Governance Law, NRS Chapter 281A, I'm disclosing that my son is an undergraduate student at UNR majoring in business and would be responsible for any higher differential fees in business and possibly other fees under consideration by the Board of Regents today In this regard, I am in the same position as every other parent with a student at UNR and will not obtain any significant pecuniary benefit by voting on this matter. I believe that I am able to vote on this matter after fairly reviewing the underlying facts. For this reason, I will be voting on the agenda item. President Johnson.
Thank you, Chair Geddes. We are presenting a two-part differential fee. The first fee would be a $35 fee going into effect in the fall of 20, and then an additional $50 per credit hour fee going into effect in the fall of 2023. The fees are to go after three objectives. One is to have a high-quality, skill-focused curriculum. Secondly, to do some extracurricular activities to support professional skills development. And third, to have competitive facilities and excellent facilities for education, as all programs with quality programs require people, program support, and good facilities. So in the first fee of $30 will go to general program support going into effect in the fall of 2020 for instructional resources, for recruiting and retention efforts through the Student Success Center, to extracurricular activities through the Career and Corporate Outreach Center, and even some of the Nevada Global Business programs to give students an opportunity to experience business abroad. $5 will be going into the design of the new college business building beginning in the fall of 2020. And then after we anticipate the building opening in the fall of 2023, then there will be a total of $55 per credit hour going into debt payment for a portion of the construction costs of the College of Business building. I would like to again call on two students who have experienced the College of Business. One will be Gabby Liu, a senior in management who is president of the Business Student Council, and the second is Elliot Parrish, a senior in accounting who is vice president of the Business Student Council. If we could go to Reno and hear these students.
Please proceed. Ladies first.
Hello. Hello, everyone. As he said, my name is Gabby Liu, and I'm the president of the Business Student Council here with Elliot. And first off, I just want to start by going over our process for gathering student feedback for this differential fee. So starting at the beginning of the semester, the Business Student Council invited all of the College of Business senators and all of the College of Business student club leaders to be a part of the conversation. So we held multiple meetings where everyone was educated in the concept as well as allowed to provide feedback. And there was also multiple meetings held for all College of Business undergraduate students to also be educated and provide their feedback as well. Through all of these meetings together, we were able to come up with our solution or come up with what we believe is the best programming needs required to satisfy the future of the College of Business, which Elliot will go over.
Hi. So as Gabby said, the dean assigned a group of students to assemble a committee to discuss and review the potential of a differential fee to help fund a new business building as well as increase instructional support for the students. This committee determined that the differential fee would be reasonable, provided that the size and programming specifications detailed in the proposal are met and held steady. The committee wishes to emphasize that if the building were to decrease in size slash programming needs, our recommendation would be withdrawn. And again, we would not support this significant differential fee if the building did not meet the programming specifications set forth in the proposal. With that being said, this fee is recommended because the College of Business at UNR is growing too fast for the space we currently occupy, and the instructional support and enhanced environment provided by the fee would help support the continued growth and success of the college. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Do I have a motion for approval? Motion from Regent Trachok, second from Regent McMichael. Any discussion? Regent Hayes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to just reiterate the
or say reference back to my previous comments. However, on this one, I do have some additional thoughts of, you know, the three reasons listed for giving this. One is to build a quality curriculum, which shouldn't that be the bare minimum that we do anyway, and we shouldn't be charging a differential fee. If we're going to offer a degree program, we should have a quality curriculum and shouldn't have to charge extra for that and extracurriculars. You know, I appreciate the students taking their time to come here today, but it was mentioned they spent a lot of time with club leaders and others who are already involved in extracurricular activities. It's first-generation students, and those that are students like I was when I went to school that are working all the time that will be paying these fees but can't actually afford to go on the extracurriculars. Even with some financial assistance, I couldn't have left my job for a week or 2 weeks to go do some extracurricular activity. It's going to be the first generation and the poorest students paying this fee for the more well-off students to do it. I'm more opposed to this one than the previous one, and then all the other reasons I stated in the prior motion, I'm opposed to this as well. Thank you.
Mr. Hayes, Regent Hayes, may I just query what the difference at differential fees at UNR is versus the one at Nevada State College and Truckee Mountains Community College that you supported?
The price of it was significantly different. It was $80 per credit hour here on this one in comparison to what they were getting out of it. What were the other reasons? I can go back through and look if you want to chat.
No, I'm just curious.
Oh, I'm happy to.
How you supported some and not the others. Was it price point?
In large part.
In large part. Okay. Regent Lieberman?
To Chair Getty's question of Regent Hayes, I have no problem with additional fees for professional programs or for additional things in nursing or chemistry or computers, but I have a concern that we're adding on to business that doesn't have extra add-ons that some of the lab sciences and other things do.
Regent Del Carlo.
Thank you, Chair Geddes. I struggle with the price point on this one, too. $85 a credit hour is really a lot of money. And I, you know, it's on top. We've already voted as a board, as Regent Hayes said, 4% increase and then another 4% increase. So I did some math and was looking at it, and it's going to add $5,100 to the cost of a business degree. You know, I would love to see, I guess, the competitiveness of our school versus our peer and aspirational institutions for that one. And I'm troubled by the fact that it's okay for the students that are going right now to pay for it or to vote for it and say they're for it, but it's not going to affect them. I wonder if next semester they would like to have $85 extra credit hour on top of their tuition, because it ends up costing $1,275 per semester if you take for 15 classes. So I can't support this either.
President Johnson?
Yes, I'd just like to point out for the the last 5 years, the differential fee in the College of Engineering has been $85 a credit hour, and they've done amazing things by adding faculty, adding career support, and many other things with that fee. And those students supported the fee. They've been paying $85 a credit hour for the last 5 years. Just wanted to let you know about that price point. It's comparative.
Regent Perkins?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, is there a point in time, like, are there deliverables? Is there a point in time where this fee goes away, or is this forever?
President Johnson?
Could I answer that question, please?
Yes, President Johnson.
Yes, this fee would not go away, and the reason we need to have it determined early is that if we're going to have a financing plan, then we have to know where the revenue is going to be for the building. So we would move to design and construct the building and get a financing plan for the building, and we would have to bridge the amount of money that this fee would raise to support the debt on the building. So, and the fee on the building would be like a 30-year loan, and that's why it wouldn't go down into the future.
Brian.
I just wanted to make one comment relative to Regent Del Carlo's question. In page 10 of the packet, actually provides some competitiveness against the Mountain West and some other comparison institutions, and we would remain sort of in the middle of the pack. It also mentions, to Regent Hayes' question, the number of other business programs that have differential fees already, and it's more than half of the institutions on this list. Thank you.
Alexander?
As a business student at UNR, I agree with Regent Del Carlo and Regent Hayes. This is something that students at UNR have mentioned to me that they are not looking forward to.
Anthony?
I know for me, from my perspective, the Student Senate voted on this, and they did pass this unanimously. And additionally, with the LASPE that I just failed, they had passed that as well, and they were informed of the circumstances. And I know from our perspective and our business students and how they interact with our student government and how we interact with them, ASUN has our budget, $2.5 million, and our administrators and our 300-plus clubs and organizations rely on our Central for Student Engagement. And Elliot is actually one of our main students, along with many other business students that work in there and manage that budget. They're incredible, and what that college produces and the students that they produce are amazing. And then when it comes to the fee and this building being implemented and students not being able to, you know, experience it, that's what happened with our Wegan Fitness Center. It wasn't there, and students realized, like, yes, we're paying this fee, but it's going to create a better future for those that are going to come after us. And I think that's something to also keep in mind is the future of Nevada and what's that supposed to look like.
Seeing no other comments, Mr. Gould?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regent Hayes?
No.
Regent Lieberman? Regent McAdoo? Regent McMichael?
Yes.
Regent Moran?
Yes.
Regent Page?
No.
Regent Perkins?
No.
Regent Trachuk?
Yes.
Regent Carter?
No.
Regent Carvalho?
No.
Regent Del Carlo?
No.
Vice Chair Dubrava?
Yes.
Chair Geddes?
Aye.
Motion fails.
Okay, we will move on to item 28, Procedures and Guidelines Manual, Student Fees. Regent Carter.
So I was a student and gaming innovation course at UNLV where I developed a casino game. If the game is marketed and sold, I'll be required to pay UNLV in the form of shared royalties pursuant to a standard contract that all students in the course were required to sign. I disclose this relationship under NRS Chapter 281A as recommended by the Nevada Commission on Ethics. As this item does not affect my interests, I'll be voting on this agenda item.
In accordance with the ethics and government law, NRS Chapter 281A, I am disclosing that my son is an undergraduate student at UNR majoring in business and would be responsible for fees, other fees under consideration by the board today. In this regard, I am in the same position as every other parent with a student at UNR and will not obtain any significant pecuniary benefit by voting on this matter. I believe I am able to vote on this matter after fairly reviewing the underlying facts. For this reason, I will be voting on the item. CFO Klinger does not have to make the disclosure because he's not voting. Yep.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Andrew Klinger here to present and request a revision to the procedures and guidelines manual related to student fees and special course fees. And Mr. Chairman and Regents wanted to point out that on page 19, which is attachment B, the technology fee, you see there's a $2 fee for the community colleges. TMCC intends to increase their technology fee by $2, and that item will be brought to the special board meeting in January.
Do I have a motion for approval? Motion from Regent Trachuk, second from Regent Dubrava.
I had a question.
Oh, sorry. Second from me. Me. Vice Chair Dubrava.
Could someone help me just a minute? What are we approving here? Is this
the entire slate of all the fees?
So the Graduate Professional Student Association, is that also?
That's within this.
Yeah. So I do have questions about that. And either President Miana or Provost Heavey could help me with this. So on page 16, I guess, currently is the fee $18 and it's going to increase to $25?
Per semester.
Per semester, per student, or
yes.
Not per credit?
No, per semester.
Okay. That does answer my question. I'm fine.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Regent Hayes.
Yes, Mr. Chair, just to preemptively answer a question you'll have, I am in favor of this, and the difference being these are small fees that have a very close tie to recording studio fees, $150 a course or things like that. So I am in favor of this, and I see a significant difference between a $80 credit hour fee and a $100 or $150 for one course fee, or as was just pointed out, the per semester fee for a graduate student.
Regent Hayes, respectfully, we will agree to disagree. One thing I would like to see, though, in looking at this list and things that are in here is I think some of these are ripe for differential fees. When I see, like, automotive technology at CSN and, you know, there's 20, 30 courses here, it might be worth, back to the truth in advertising and what it costs to get the degree, that we don't have all these fees added on to the per-credit fee and just say, if you're going to go into automotive, you're going to have to pay an additional fee to cover it and get rid of all these individual course fees. I know there's some areas, maybe in art in the 100 level, you kind of got to keep them there because some students are just taking it for the core or to build it up. But if you're looking at a degree program, I also saw it in welding there, I think it would be worth taking a look at some of those and consider if those should go to differential fees and not special course fees, although it may be easier to pass them this way. Any other questions or comments? We have a motion and a second. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Item number 29, Procedures and Guidelines Manual, Revision, RN to VSN, Tuition and Fees. President Patterson.
Thank you, Chair Getty. So, simplistically stated, this item is simply moving the residential rate to the regular tuition rate, which would include the heavy increases that have been approved by the board in the past. Because we fixed the residential rate approximately two or three years ago when we set this, it hasn't kept pace with the regular tuition rate, so it's actually lower than the regular tuition rate. For now, we're keeping the non-residential rate fixed, because we're trying to gain competitive traction regionally, and we're slowly making progress with that, but we'll continue to examine that. Vice President Butler here is here to answer any detailed questions.
Do I have a motion for approval? Motion from Regent Trachok, second. From Regent Page. Any questions or comments? Seeing none, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Item number 30, Ad Hoc UNLV President Search Committee, Chair Lieberman. I'm sorry, just one second. Regent Carter.
Okay. So I was previously a student at the Gaming Innovation course at UNLV where I developed a casino game. If that game is developed and sold, I'll be required to pay UNLV in the form of shared royalties pursuant to a standard contract that all students in the course are required to sign. I disclose this relationship under NRS Chapter 281A, as recommended by the Nevada Commission on Ethics. As this item does not affect my interests, I will be voting on this agenda item.
Chair Lieberman.
Thank you. You can read the report. We had a very robust discussion with the advisory board about what the position should look like. We worked very closely with Wheelis consultants to discuss the process of the number of candidates that we'll be bringing to campus and the type of person we're looking for in the position. And I think that we will be ready to bring people on campus early this spring so that when we hire, they will have plenty of time to give notice at their previous institution or location and be able to be here in the spring or this summer. So please read the minutes for your details.
We have a motion to approve the report. Do I have a second?
Second
from Regent Trachok. Any questions or comments? All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion passes unanimously. Ad hoc Chancellor Search Committee. Regent Page.
Thank you, Chair Geddes. The committee met. We had a robust discussion, spent a lot of time around the job description. Dealing with the consultant at the meeting and the follow-up, I think they're doing a great job, very thorough in all their work, and we look forward to future meetings.
I have a motion to accept the report.
Do I have a second? Motion to accept.
Second from Regent Carter. Any questions or comments? Seeing none, all in favor, signify by saying aye. All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Item 32, Cultural Diversity Committee. Chair Lieberman.
I offer that you can read the minutes for yourself, but I also want to highlight that we had a wonderful presentation regarding the HSI-MSI summit at CSN. The diversity summit was at UNLV. It was very, very well attended, and Ambassador Shabazz was a wonderful keynote, and we also had a presentation on changing the guidelines for assistive technology within the system for people with disabilities and people not with disabilities. And we finally heard from a UNR professor who was highlighted in the School of Medicine, State of the School. His name is Dr. Ryan Weebles, and he discussed his life story and his research in muscular dystrophy. So that is my report, and I entertain a motion.
We have a motion to accept the report. Second from Regent McAdoo. Any questions or comments? Seeing none, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Item 33, Academic Research and Student Affairs Committee, Regent Carter. No?
It should be me.
No, it's he had a disclosure.
Disclosure. So I was a previous student at the gaming innovation course at UNLV where I developed a casino game.
You were?
I was, yeah. If it's marketed and sold, I'll be required to pay UNLV in the form of shared royalties. I disclose this relationship, according to the Nevada Ethics Commission. As this item does not affect my interests, I will be voting on this agenda item.
Chair McAdoo.
Thank you. So a big thank you to Winter, Carrie, and Jennifer for getting the chair's reports out in such a timely fashion. We've all received those. I have the best expectations that everyone's looked at them. I will just say to you that every action item was approved unanimously in the committee, and we heard some great reports of academic review, and so I entertain a motion to approve.
Thank you. Got a motion from Regent McAdoo, second from Regent Del Carlo. Any questions or comments? All in favor signify by saying aye. All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Item 34, Business, Finance, and Facilities Committee. Chair Hayes.
Do we need to start with Regent Carter?
No.
Oh, he needs a sign he can just hold up. In the Business, Finance, and Facilities Committee, we had a very packed, long agenda that we got through with a lot of efficiency and thoroughness combined. The gist of it is UNR bought and sold a lot of land, got given a little land, bought a building, Ponderosa Village. It was the dorms for the graduate students. And then we approved the financing for both the Ponderosa Village graduate student housing and the new garage in the Gateway section there facing I-80. And then Nevada State College, we approved them borrowing some money to buy some nursing lab equipment because they would be able to get a savings by buying it before the end of this year versus next year, and had some favorable financing terms. There was much more that we did, but as Regent McAdoo pointed out, you've all seen the minutes and report on that. If you have any questions about it, feel free to ask. Otherwise, I would love if someone would approve a motion to approve or accept the committee report.
So moved. Motion from Chair Hayes, second from Regent Carvalho. Any questions or comments?
Who's the second?
Regent Carvalho. Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Item 35, Audit Compliance and Title IX Committee, Regent Carter, followed by Chair Carter.
Here you go. So, I was in a gaming innovation class, as you might recall.
Really?
And if that game is marketed and sold, I have to pay a royalty to UNLV. I disclose this relationship under the Nevada Commission on Ethics, and I will be abstaining from one item, but I'll tell you that at the end of the report. So, in the Audit Committee, we had several information items. It was our Grant Thornton presentation as well. We approved the minutes from the previous meeting, in addition with a follow-up audits for Thomas and Mack purchasing cards at GBC and Nevada State. We looked at the internal audit reports from the Foundation, Travel and Crime Statistics. We reviewed all the audits from Grant Thornton. If you have not looked at those, please do so. There's several findings for financial aid, and some of those are repeat findings. There's one finding with the University of Nevada Reno School of Medicine where they reported $1 million difference in 2018, which kind of inflated that number and would have deflated it for 19, and that's all in there as well as the financial statements for UNLV. And we'll have a follow-up report on one of the items that's now required part of the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, which was a new finding for the report as they did not have their plans ready yet for most of our schools. I move to approve and accept the audit compliance and Title IX report, except for Item 12, the one related to UNLV.
Actually, the follow-up at Thomas and Mack.
Right. There's three.
The communication with charges, with governance, and the financial statements. The last two.
Okay.
So all but those three. So
correct.
I move to approve or to accept the report, except for those three items.
We have a motion from Chair Carter, second from Regent Page. Any questions or comments? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously.
Move to approve the three other items.
Motion from Regent Hayes, second from Regent Page. Any questions or comments? All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. With one abstention. Item number 36, Health Sciences System Committee, Regent Carter.
It's the last time. I was previously a student in the gaming innovation course at UNLV where I developed a casino game. If that game is marketed and sold, I'll be required to pay UNLV in the form of shared royalties pursuant to a standard contract that all students in the course were required to sign. I disclose this relationship under NRS Chapter 281A as recommended by the Nevada Commission on Ethics. As this item does not affect my interests, I will be voting on this agenda item.
Chair Page.
Thank you, Chair Geddes. We heard both from the UNLV and UNR Schools of Medicine. Had a report on Nevada mental health workforce from Dr. Sarah Hunt, which was very well done. I would recommend, if you haven't read it, look at the report. We did have, actually, an action item, and so I'm going to recommend that we eliminate this committee because it's our first action item that I've seen for the UNLV School of Medicine the practice plan bylaws, articles, and incorporation and operating agreement. And then we had an update on the two practice plans and they are both in the red for different reasons. With that, I move for approval.
Do I have a second?
I would second just because it's such a monumental, momentous occasion that we had an action item other than the minutes in health sciences.
Regent Carvalho beat you, but I appreciate the sentiment. Any other questions or comments? Seeing none, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, nay. Motion carries unanimously. Item 37, we don't need to go to Regent Carter. We have moved that to the March meeting where we will get those updated reports and procedures and guideline manual revisions, which brings us to item 38, new business. Regent Hayes, did you? No? We're on new business.
Did I have something?
You said yes.
I don't know. I thought you said you had one. Regent Perkins.
Well, Regent Carter's, or while Regent Trevor Hayes is thinking about it, I have new business. I would like to ask a question about the HSI and the Diversity Summit. Can they be combined or wrapped around so that, like, maybe the HSI is at the beginning and the diversity is in the middle, so that's like one continuous couple of days as opposed to 2 days here and two, and you know, 1 day here, 3 days here, 2 days here. Just putting that out there. The next one is about when I was listening to all the needs for funding and how we fall short on one side and we're in a deficit on the other. Could we possibly look at combining SCS to take on some of the
little pockets of information that, or information that are services that are not being handled by them currently within the institutions. Just putting that out there too. And lastly, but not least, for the AJR 5, I know I'm not supposed to talk about it. However, could we have like maybe an ad hoc committee of what we as regents can do to educate and publicize what we actually do and how important this board is to the state of Nevada, like in an intentional manner?
I think when this came up before, and I'm going to defer to Chief General Counsel Reynolds, but I think this came up at another meeting, and we were told by Chief that it is actually unlawful for the body to talk about the resolution, but I'll let him speak about it.
Joe Reynolds, for the record. Provisions in our ethics chapter in NRS 281A, you know, prohibit a government entity from expending resources to advocate for or against a ballot initiative. And, you know, as elected officials, you could certainly make comments in discussions, but would be very cautious and concerned to actually form any type of committee by this body to do
so
that.
So as individuals, we can – I wasn't thinking about expending any expenses. I was just thinking about some of the things that we do currently, like the meetings we attend, the, you know, the business places that we belong to, the commerce institutions that we belong to, maybe speaking there and letting them know what we do.
I think what we'll do is get Chief Counsel Reynolds to put up guardrails of what we can and can't do and get it out to all of us, and then we can proceed from there, if that's okay with.
Yes, it is, Mr. Chairman.
Right. I'm done.
Yeah, Mr. Vice Chair.
Just one sec. Regent Hayes and then Regent Moran.
So you were correct. I went back through my notes. It was the date of our fourth quarter meeting. I know it's tough with the holidays, and maybe it's not possible to move. I mean, we certainly don't want to move it to next week when they actually have finals. But to maybe just take a look and see, is there a way to have it the fourth quarter meeting, maybe in mid-November or early November, so it avoids that. That's all.
Thank you. Regent Moran.
Oh, yes, Mr. Vice Chair, or Mr. Chair, excuse me. I kind of had the same thoughts that that Regent Perkins, and I think I was the one that instituted the conversation the last go-around relative to AJR 5. And I think that, I mean, I understand 281A pretty well, very intimately, having served as its chair, not being one of the recipients. But in any event, I think that we should at least be able to have an opportunity to seek guidance from council relative to how it would roll out. And I mean, I know that it's gone from being a legislative mandate to now becoming an initiative that's going to be voted on. Does that change the trajectory of what we can consider as a group? Because I know that we gave testimony on it when it was in the legislature at both sessions that it passed. In fact, I think you gave testimony at some point. But so now, is there a change? Is my question to legal counsel is, since it's no longer a legislative effort, it's now an initiative, is that why we can't discuss it or have some sort of a committee relative to the future discussion of how it's going to look?
I think that's the direction we'll get from General Counsel Reynolds, is we'll have him explain to us what the difference was prior to what it is now and what we can do now on a going forward basis. And I would expect him to present all our options to us.
So the idea is that General Counsel will be able to put together some sort of like a white paper or a memorandum that would be circulated relative to what AJR 5 is.
Just really a legal memo on what our do's and don'ts are around a resolution that will be on the ballot.
I don't want to waste too much of anybody's time. Believe you me, the institutional leaders need to get back to their day jobs. But for me, I think it would be worthwhile to understand, you know, the workings of that. I mean, how is that eventually going to end up shoring up? A lot of the questions that I get from my constituents is, how does this work? Because it is starting to get a little bit of political media traction, so to speak, as we move into the vote. And I'm just trying to – I want to know how we can answer as a
– Exactly.
As a team, you know, as a board, how should we be addressing these questions that are presented from our constituents?
We will put it as new business on a future agenda item and have General Counsel Reynolds guide us.
Oh, so you are going
well,
to...
Well, it won't be new business, will it?
No, that was a new business request. It will be on a future agenda item.
Okay, yeah.
But only as to what the board is allowed and not allowed to discuss. It's not... I mean, it's up to the chair, but... And it's going to be subject to the parameters that the Chief General Counsel lays out. If he says we can only discuss within this boundary, that's what we will discuss.
No, I'm not concerned. I'm less concerned about the conversations that we can have amongst ourselves. I don't think that's going to change. What I'm talking about is having the ability to have our counsel brief us as to content, as to,
We will get that on an agenda. So
you're going to do that. That's going
we
to
We will
happen.
Discuss it on a future agenda.
And I appreciate the time.
Regent Magnitude.
I am just letting you know that I have a plane to catch, and we're usually out of here on Fridays in time for me to be on that. So I'm taking off, but I want to wish every one of you, I'm going to say the merriest of Christmas, happy Hanukkah, happy holidays, whatever suits you, but I want you to have a wonderful, peaceful holiday. Thank you.
Seeing no other new business, we'll go to public comment in Elko.
No public comment in Elko.
Public comment in Reno.
And there's no public comment in Reno.
Public comment in Las Vegas. Please approach the podium. State your name. You have 2 minutes.
Good afternoon. My name is Valeria Saborio, S-A-B-O-R-I-O for the record. I am the Vice President of TMCC Student Government Association. I was not able to do public comment on this respective session, but I am one of the many hundreds of TMCC's Scholarship Foundation recipients, and on behalf of them, I just want to say thank you. I'm an international student from Costa Rica, and I'm an engineering student, and I'm also a student with a disability. Despite my hearing loss, I have not been backtracked from this, and I've been encouraged by TMCC to participate as a vice president, a student, and an international peer mentor. Dr. Hilgersum, you're an amazing president. I really thank you, your support and your participation in involving us and TMCC. And you are an outstanding president. Thank you, TMCC Foundation, for your incredible support, and thank you, Board of Regents, for all the work you do. Pura vida.
Thank you. Any other public comment in Las Vegas? We are adjourned.